Harper Audio presents Tom Clancy's NetForce No. 5, Point of Impact. Created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachenik. Read by J.K. Simmons. Saturday, October 1st, 2011, Atlantic City, New Jersey.
We should go outside and enjoy the sunny weather, Mary Lou said.
Bert snickered. Right, we drove all the way from the Bronx to Atlantic City to take the goddamn sun. I can sit on a stoop at home. I want to get hot. No thank yous. I'm happy right here.
Bert fed another dollar into the slot machine and pushed the button. He didn't like the new electronic machines as much as the old mechanical ones, like those in the back rooms of the New Jersey bars where his father used to sneak off with him when he was a kid. Those had been fun, with the big arm you pulled down and the real wheels going round and round. He didn't quite trust the new ones to pay off. It'd be too easy for some computer geek to rig 'em so they'd keep every damn dime you put in. But it was what it was. Hell, he was up $75, he should complain.
Around him, the machines flashed colored lights, hummed and whirred and played crappy music, and now and then dropped tokens into a metal tray.
Mary Lou said, "There's something you don't see every day."
The slot screen whirled to stop on a bar, a cherry, and a picture of some dead rock star. Crap. Only $74 ahead now.
Irritated, Bert said,
"What?" "Over there, look it."
He saw right away what she meant. There was a fat, white-haired old guy, maybe 65, walking into the casino. The way he moved, he was like a man with a mission. Nothing unusual there, except the dude was in a tiny red Speedo and nothing else.
"God, I'm trying to win money here. You want to make me puke? There ought to be a law against a suit like that if you're 30 pounds overweight."
"Probably there is. I'm pretty sure the casino rules say no swimsuits without a robe and some kind of sandals or shoes, though."
"There you go. See, the security guard is going to toss him out."
A big uniformed guard, 6'5", 260 easy, angled toward the fat guy in the red Speedo. Speedo smiled at the giant guard, grabbed him by the arms just under his shoulders, picked him up, and threw him like the guy was a toy. The guard smashed into a slot machine with a loud rattling crash.
"Holy shit," Bert said.
Two more guards came running, pulling out those expandable steel batons they carried as they ran. Speedo took a couple of steps to the nearest slot. It was bolted to the floor, so Bert didn't know what the guy thought he was going to do with it. Still smiling, Speed wrenched the slot from the floor and threw that, too. Made a hell of a noise. Bert stared, frozen. This wasn't possible. There was no way this flabby old dude had the muscle to do what he'd just done. No way. Nobody was that strong. The second security guard let fly with his expandable nightstick, took a good crack at Speedo's white head. Speedo reached up, grabbed the baton as it came down, jerked it from the guard's grip, and threw it. The thing whistled as it whirled away, so fast Bert couldn't even track it. He shoved the guard one-handed, and the guy just flew into two bystanders and knocked all three of them down. The third guard, seeing what had happened to the other two, dropped his baton and went for his pistol. Bert thought this was a real good idea. Speedo took a couple of quick steps, really quick steps, and caught the guard's wrist before he cleared leather. 30 feet away, Bert heard the sound of the man's arm bones breaking. Oh, man. The guard fell to his knees, screaming in pain, and Speedo stepped around him. Then Speedo waded through the casino like Sherman through Georgia. He knocked over slots, he upended card tables, he flipped a roulette wheel table completely over. People scrambled to get out of his way. He was a human wrecking ball. He was smiling while he did it, and Bert couldn't begin to understand how he was doing it. It seemed like a long time, but it couldn't have been more than a minute or two before the local cops showed up, six of them in full battle array. The first couple of cops to reach Speedo tried to whack him with their batons, and Speedo grabbed one and used him like a club on the second. The other four cops were smarter. One of them fast drew his pepper spray, another pulled an air taser, and both let loose. Speedo ran at the cops. Through the pepper fog and from where he stood, Bert saw the two electric taser needles in the old man's chest. Either one should have stopped him, had him gagging or jittering like a spider on a hot stove, but he never slowed. Speedo slammed into the next two cops, knocking them sprawling. He looked pissed off now, and he scooped one of the cops from the floor, a big black dude who probably went 200 pounds, and shot-putted the cop at a thick plate glass partition that separated a cafeteria hall from the casino floor. The partition shattered, shards of glass flew everywhere, and the cop would be lucky if he wasn't slashed to hamburger.
Everybody down! One of the two remaining cops screamed. Down! Down! Down!
People hit the floor, but Speedo wasn't one of them, and Bert stayed up watching, too. The two cops had their pistols out by now. Speedo looked at them and smiled, a kind of sad smile, like he felt sorry for them. He started walking toward the cops.
Stop, asshole!
He didn't. Both cops fired, a couple three times each. Speedo kept coming, and they kept shooting. Bert saw the hits on the old man, saw dark puckers appear in his arms and chest, wounds that oozed blood, but he kept going. People screamed, but the cops kept blasting away. Bert tried to keep count of the shots, but there were too many of them. 15, 18? They were going to town. It was like some monster movie. The old guy just kept shambling toward the cops.
Fuck!
One of the cops yelled. He turned and ran. The other cop clicked empty. Then, when Speedo was almost on top of him, he threw the Glock at the old man. The old man grabbed the cop, managed to get him 5 or 6 inches off the floor. Then the old man finally ran out of gas. He dropped the cop and fell, landing on the floor face down. It got real quiet in the casino then.
Holy shit, Bert said softly.
Amen, sweet Jesus, Mary Lou said.
Amen.
Sunday, October 2nd, Washington, D.C. Alex Michaels grunted as the socket slipped off the hex nut and his hand shot forward to scrape his knuckles on the rocker arm cover.
Ow, crap!
From the kitchen, he heard Tony call out,
You okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Stupid piece of crap Chevrolet.
Tony drifted into the garage doorway. He was leaning over the fender on the passenger side, under the hood, so he saw her. 5 months pregnant, in one of his T-shirts and a pair of drawstring sweatpants, she was, if anything, more beautiful than ever. She smiled.
That's not what you said when you were convincing me you needed to have it. A 55 Bel Air convertible, you said. A classic.
Yeah, well, that was before I had a chance to spend time with it. Thing is engineered like a tank.
Also a selling point, if I recall.
He looked at the nut. It was tight enough. He put the wrench down, grabbed a red rag and some of the pungent-smelling lanolin hand cleaner, and started wiping grease off his fingers. Well, it was a classic car. Created by the chief engineer of General Motors in the post-World War II years, Edward Coles, with legendary designer Harvey Earl, the 55 introduced the small-block V8 engine, the 265, later the 283, and then the 327. These engines became the standard against which all others were measured for more than 40 years. A convertible in top condition would cost $60,000 to $75,000 easy. Even one in so-so shape like this one wasn't cheap. He smiled back at her.
I thought it was your job to keep me from running off half-cocked.
I don't recall that part of the marriage vow.
He walked toward her.
How did your juru practice go?
Her smile disappeared and frown lines wrinkled her forehead.
Terrible. I'm all off balance. When I dropped into the squat for Juru 5, I farted.
He couldn't help it. He laughed. Her face clouded up, tears welling.
It's not funny, Alex. I feel like a big fat cow.
Michaels hurried to her. He hugged her to him.
Hey, it's all right.
No, it's not. If I can't practice my Silat, I'll go crazy.
This was not the time for him to point out that her doctor had told her to avoid exercise because of some bleeding early in the pregnancy. Everything seemed to be all right, but just to be sure, Tony was supposed to take it easy. That theoretically included Tony not doing the short dances of the Indonesian martial art in which she was an expert. No, definitely not the time to bring that up. A wrong word and she'd start crying, which was so unlike her that it still amazed him every time. It was just hormones, the doctor had said, a normal part of pregnancy, but Michaels still hadn't gotten used to it.
Maybe you should just, you know, take a break from Juru's. It's only another 4 months until the baby is born.
Take a break? I've done Juru's almost every day since I was 13. I can't just give them up for 4 months.
Maybe it was better if he just kept his mouth shut. It had been a long time since he'd been around a pregnant woman. When his first wife, Megan, had been carrying their daughter, Susie, he had still been working in the field and was gone quite a bit. He'd missed a lot of the experience, and at the time, he'd been sorry he had.
Now he was the commander of the FBI's elite subunit NetForce, and maybe he might be spending a little more time at the office until things settled down at home. He immediately felt guilty at that thought.
"I know it's not your fault," Tony said.
"Well, okay, it is your fault, technically speaking," she grinned. "But I don't blame you." He smiled back at her. Her mood swing was instant. Zap, just like that, from angry to happy.
"Go on back and finish installing your carburetor. I'm going to sit down and see if I can get your son to stop kicking my bladder."
"You sure are pretty when you're pregnant."
"Forget it. One baby, that's my limit."
Tony went to her computer and slid the VR band down over her eyes, adjusting the earplugs and olfactory bulbs so they were comfortable. The set was wireless, so she could prop her feet up on a cushion while she was online. She put on the tactile gloves and was ready. There was a small moment of disorientation as the virtual reality program took over and constructed a shopping mall in place of the small office that had been the guest bedroom. She found herself in front of a virtual elevator, the door of which opened. She stepped inside, along with other shoppers.
"Arts and crafts, please," she said.
Somebody tapped a button. The sensation was of rising rather than falling. After a moment, a chime sounded and the door opened. Tony alighted and looked at the sign a few feet away. "You are here," pulsed in a pale green light.
"No, I'm at home in my office."
But the suspension of disbelief that was VR was easy enough to accept. She found the place she was looking for listed, Hergertz Scrimshaw, and she headed toward it. When she and Alex had been on their honeymoon in Hawaii, they'd gone to an art gallery. There had been some world-class work in the gallery, in all kinds of media and materials, everything from pencil drawings to sculptures in bronze. But what had impressed her the most was a small display of micro Scrimshaw. There were pictures engraved on small bits of fossilized ivory, old piano keys and billiard balls, even a couple of sperm whale teeth. Some of the images were smaller than her thumbnail, but when viewed under magnification, showed a wealth of detail she would not have thought possible. There were sailing ships and whales, portraits, nudes, tigers, and several with fantasy elements. She had been particularly impressed by a tiny black-and-white rendering of a long-haired naked woman sitting in a lotus position and gazing up at the heavens, but floating 2 feet above the ground. The image had been done on a pale ivory disc the size of a quarter.
"How do they do that?" she'd asked Alex.
"I don't know. Let's ask."
The gallery manager was happy to explain.
"There are different ways," she said, "but in this case what the artist did was to polish the ivory smooth, then use a very fine pointed instrument, probably something like a sewing needle, to put thousands of tiny dots into the material. It's a process called stippling. Then he rubbed the color onto it. This is a Bob Hergert piece, and he prefers oil paint to ink. I believe he uses a shade called lamp black. Once the piece was covered with paint, he wiped it clean, and the oil paint filled up the stipple marks but came off the polished part. It has to be done under magnification, of course, and it is, as you might suspect, rather painstaking work."
"I can only imagine," Tony said. "It's beautiful."
"Yes, Bob is one of the better artists working in the medium."
"How much?" Alex asked.
$800 for this one."
"We'll take it."
"No, Alex, we can't."
"Yes, we can. It'll be your wedding present."
"But
I made a good profit on my last car restoration. We can afford it."
As she packaged the Scrimshaw, the manager said to Tony, "If you are ever interested in seeing how he does it, Bob teaches an online course." At the time, Tony had nodded and murmured something polite, not thinking such artwork would ever be something she'd have time for. As she walked through the virtual mall, she smiled to herself. Well, she had time now. Plenty of time. She was supposed to sit around for the next 4 months, and even if she wanted to practice her Selat, she was, for all practical purposes, a beached whale. But sitting at a table and scratching on a piece of faux ivory with a pin, she could do that. Of course, she didn't really have much artistic talent, but maybe she could learn. She arrived in front of a small shop. On the window it said, "Bob Hergert, Micro Scrimshaw, www.scrimshander.com. Tony took a deep breath, let it out, and walked into the shop. Inside, there were glass-topped cases with pieces of ivory on black velvet. Several magnifying glasses on little stands had been set up on the glass so that the smaller pieces under them were easier to see. A medium-sized man with a thick mustache came out of the back and smiled at Tony.
"I bought one of your pieces in Hawaii," she said. "A naked woman sitting in a lotus pose, floating in the air."
"Ah, Cynthia, the goddess of the moon. I enjoy doing that one. How can I help you, Mrs. Michaels?" she said, still feeling somewhat strange about using Alex's name.
"Tony.
Tony, nice to meet you. I understand you give lessons in how to do this," she waved, taking in the shop's interior.
"Yes, ma'am, I surely do.
I'd like to sign up if I could."
"No problem at all, Tony."
NetForce HQ, Quantico, Virginia.
"You look like hell, Julio."
"Thank you, General Howard, sir, for your astute observation."
"What happened?"
"I was up half Sunday night feeding the baby, your godson."
"I thought Joanna was breastfeeding."
"Yeah, she is, but somebody told her about a little pump that lets you take Mama's milk out of the original container and put it into little bottles. That way the father can be part of the suckling process."
"Don't look at me. I didn't tell her."
"No, it was Nadine, your lovely wife, who was the snake in the garden."
Howard laughed.
"Well, Sergeant Fernandez, you know how women are. Never let a man spend too much time getting by with something."
"Amen. Now, if the General is through being amused, I'd like to go catch a nap."
"Go ahead, Sergeant." "Oh, wait. Hold up a second. I got something for you." Howard grinned, lighting up his handsome black face. He was going to like what he was about to do. He was going to like it a whole lot. Howard tossed a small plastic box at him. He caught it, started to open it.
"Not my birthday. What's the occasion?"
Howard just kept grinning.
When Julio got the box open, his eyes went wide.
"Oh, shit! No!"
"Oh, shit, yes. And we're skipping right over Shavetail and going right to first. Congratulations, Lieutenant Fernandez."
"You can't do this, John. Gunny'll never let me live it down."
"Already done, Julio. Paperwork is signed, sealed, and delivered."
"John..."
"More money, which you need with a new baby. Plus now you don't have to take orders from your wife. Well, no more than any of the rest of us have to take orders from our wives."
Julio's wife was Joanna Winthrop, and a lieutenant in NetForce herself, although she was on extended leave at the moment. Julio shook his head.
"I'll be damned."
"No doubt."
Julio looked up.
"Thank you, sir."
"Don't look so sour, Julio. Welcome to the Officer and a Gentleman Club, or at least the officer part of it."
"Yeah, right."
Under the bitching, Howard was pretty sure that Julio was pleased. They'd been working together for more than 20 years, first in the regular army, then in NetForce.
"Go take your nap, Lieutenant."
"Yes, sir."
Washington, D.C.
Normally at 7 in the morning, Jay Gridley would be at NetForce HQ, plugged into his computer and making war on the bad guys. He'd be hunting lubefoots who dumped the latest ugly virus into the world's email, or searching for clues to some computer fraud, or trying to track down some sicko posting kiddie porn. Now and then there'd be a big shark cruising the virtual waters of the net, like the mad Russian, or the crazy Georgia redneck, or the British genius who'd been using a quantum computer to try and restore England's lost glory, though those were relatively rare. But a few months ago, Jay had finally met his online guru who had been helping him recover from a stroke, an old Tibetan monk named Sojan Rinpoche. And as it turned out, the old man was actually a young and beautiful woman. Saji, she liked to be called, and one thing had led to another, which had led to her lying beside him in the bed. Now, there were days when he called in sick and never left that bed except to pee. He giggled.
"What is funny?" Saji asked.
He smiled at her.
"You?
Me?
This?
Us?
What time is it?"
"Who cares?"
"No, you don't, goat boy. I am teaching an online class this morning." "You don't have to get up for that. You can lie right here."
She laughed.
"I don't think so. I remember the last time I tried to do that, somebody kept distracting me." "You're a master Buddhist. You're supposed to be able to meditate and tune out little distractions."
"Yeah, but the problem was the little distraction kept getting bigger every time I looked at it."
They both laughed. "Work is dead. I could stay home. It's totally boring there these days, seriously."
"Seriously, no, you can't."
"You are a party pooper." Jay rolled out of the bed and padded toward the bathroom.
"You want a shower?"
"Yes, after you leave."
You don't trust me. I'm hurt.
I can see that. Go on. I'll cook supper when you get home.
He grinned at her.
Boy, did he like having her around. Really. A lot. More than anything he could think of.
He headed for the shower and considered for the 100th time, was it possible to make it permanent? As in, getting married? Would she go for it? There was only one way to find out, but what if she said no? That would be bad.
The hot water began to steam up the bathroom. He was rinsing the shampoo from his hair when the shower door slid open and Saji followed the draft of cool air in, gloriously naked and grinning.
Why, Sojan Rinpoche, what are you doing here?
I came to wash your back, is all.
Uh-huh.
Turn around.
Yes, ma'am.
He turned around. She reached out and her soapy hand began rubbing him. However, the hand was definitely not stroking his back.
Nope. No, sir. No, indeedy.
He laughed and she laughed with him.
Yep, he was going to be late for work. No two ways about it. Hey, I think you missed a spot there.
I didn't miss it. I was ignoring it. Easy to do. It's so small.
Ooh, you are a cruel woman. Cruel.
Malibu, California. Robert Drain looked up from his mixing bench in front of the big picture window as a pair of young women in thong bikinis jogged past on the wet sand just at the waterline. The sky was clear, the Pacific Ocean a nice blue. Not bad for a Monday. He grinned. He loved this town. He looked back at the bench. He had a batch ready to time and encapsulate. Only 6 hits. And where the hell was Tad? He didn't want to start the clock ticking and then have the stuff sit on the table. That might cut things a little close. As if in response, the door alarm ching-chinged as somebody disarmed it and entered the house. That had better be Tad. Drain dumped a bit of catalyst into the white compound, stirred in the fine red powder so that the resulting mix started turning pale pink. Drain worked by sight and smell. He kept adding catalyst until the right shade was achieved, and that sharp cherry and almond odor drifted up and told him it was about right, too.
Ah, there we go.
About fucking time, Drain said. Traffic is bad on the coast highway, Tad said. How's it coming?
Catalyst mixed as of 30 seconds ago.
Tad looked at his watch. Drain grabbed one of the big purple gel caps, a special run he'd had made 3 years ago by a guy in Mexico. He opened the cap and scooped up the mix with both halves, expertly judging how much so that he could put the cap together again without overfilling it. He looked up and smiled. This was the easy part. The real work was in the creation and mixing of the various components. That had to be done in a lab. And the current one was an RV parked in a dinky burg on the edge of the Mojave Desert a couple of hours away. The old retired couple driving it looked about as illegal and dangerous as a bowl of prunes. Tad Burshaw was Drain's age. Well, actually, he was a year younger at 31, but he looked 50. Rode hard and put up wet, like Drain's grandma used to say. Tad was black-haired, skinny, pale, and had dark splotches under his eyes, a real heroin chic kind of guy. He always wore black, even in the middle of summer. Long sleeves, long pants, pointy-toed leather boots. And sunglasses, of course. He looked like a vampire, or maybe one of the old beatniks, because he also had a little patch of hair under his lip. Drain, on the other hand, looked like a surfer, which he had been. Tanned, sun-bleached, dishwater blonde hair, still enough muscle to pass for a gymnast or a swimmer. He had to admit, they made an odd-looking couple when they went out. Not that they went out that often. Drain put the finished cap down and picked up another empty. He had enough mix for 6. 5 for sale and 1 for Tad. At $1,000 each, it wasn't a bad day's work. Not bad at all, given that their costs were about $35 a cap.
You heard about the guy in Atlantic City? Tad asked.
Drain worked on the third cap.
Olivetti?
Yeah.
No, what happened?
Hammer ate him. He ran amok, tore up a casino, beat the shit out of some rent-a-cops and local police before they cooked him. DOA.
Drain shrugged.
Too bad. He was a good customer.
We got a guy coming from NYC, says Olivetti referred him. Are we interested?
Drain finished the fourth cap.
No. If Olivetti is dead, the reference is dead. We don't sell to him.
First time we get a guy we can't check out, that will be a narc. You gotta figure it that way.
I hear you.
Drain finished the fifth cap, reached for Tad's empty.
How are you working today's produce?
3 off the net, FedEx same day as soon as we get the payment transfers to the dissolving account. 1 is a pickup, 3 messenger drop, 1 is hand-to-hand.
Who's the hand-to-hand?
The Z-ster.
Drain grinned.
Be sure to tell him we want tickets to his next premiere. Already in the pipe.
Okay, here you go. Last one is yours. Be sure the double special, that's number 5, goes out.
I'm gone.
See you later, Drain said. Tad left, and Drain went to open a bottle of champagne. He had 750,000 cash in a suitcase hidden in a floor safe under his bed, another 200,000+ in a safety deposit box in a bank in Tarzana, and 5 cases of assorted but all high-quality champagne in the cool room downstairs. Life was pretty damn good. Tad swung his souped-up, reconditioned Charger RT Drain had given him out into the road the locals called PCH and stomped the gas pedal, heading south towards Santa Monica. The big motor roared and laid 500 miles worth of expensive rubber compound behind it, tires squealing and smoking. Tad grinned as the car accelerated. No big deal. The radials were good for 50,000 miles, and he didn't expect either the car or himself to be around when the tire's warranty ran out. He'd been on borrowed time for years. That Bobby was a smart one. He was a certified fucking genius, no shit. IQ way up in Mensa territory, though you'd never guess he was anything more than a big old dumb surfer dude by looking at him. He could have gone into any kind of legit work and made a mint. But he had these quirks. 1, he hated his old man, who was a retired FBI agent. And 2, the guy he most wanted to be like was some flower-power drug guru from the 60s, a guy named Owsley, who came out of the psychedelic movement. Owsley was so long ago that when he started making LSD, it was still legal. Bobby wanted to be the Owsley of the 20-teens, an outlaw to the core. Tad patted his pocket for the 4th time, making sure the 5 caps were still in there. The other cap, his cap, that was tucked away in his private stash bottle in the special pocket in his right boot, right next to the short Damascus dagger he carried there. He lit up a cigarette, inhaled deeply, and coughed. His lungs were bad. Never had gotten much stronger after the TB was cured and he got out of the sanitarium in New Mexico, and smoking only made him worse. But to hell with it. He wasn't going to live long enough for cancer to get him anyhow. He couldn't do the hammer today. Too much work. So it would have to be tonight or tomorrow. He knew when he needed to drop to get off. He didn't want to miss that window. Sure, Bobby would make him another, but it would be such a waste. There was no way Tad was going to let it happen. Tonight, definitely. He would become Thor, and he would swing the hammer high, wide, and anywhere he damn well pleased. Oh, yeah. Some asshole in a low-slung Italian something or the other whipped around Tad and blew past. Guy looked like a movie star. Might even be one, in designer shades and a big expensive smile when he flashed his caps to show Tad there was no hard feelings. Tad wouldn't bother chasing the guy. Even if he caught him, the guy would certainly be able to stomp his butt for his trouble.
Come back and see me tonight, pal. See how your SoCal pretty boy tough guy act plays when I'm swinging Mjolnir high, wide, and repeatedly. Be a different story then, old son. A whole different story.
On I-95 approaching Quantico, Virginia. Michaels was on the way to his office when his Virgil blared out the opening chords for Mustang Sally. He smiled at the little electronic device. Jay Gridley had been at it again, reprogramming the attention call. He shook his head as he unclipped the Virgil for Virtual Global Interface Link from his belt and saw that the incoming call was from his boss, Melissa Allison, director of the FBI. Her image appeared on the tiny screen as he said, "Answer call," and activated the Virgil's Voxax control.
"Good morning, Alex."
"Director?"
"If you would please stop by my office on your way in, I would appreciate it. Something has come up that I think NetForce needs to address."
"Yes, ma'am, I'm on my way. I'll be there in 15 minutes."
She looked at something off-screen.
"I see you're on the freeway. You might want to take an alternate route. There's an accident a couple of miles ahead of you. Traffic will start backing up pretty fast."
"Thank you. Discom."
It used to bother him that they could GPS him that way, using the Virgil's carrier sig to tell exactly where he was. He smiled at his thought. Paranoid? Maybe. But stranger things had happened in the U.S. intelligence service, and he wouldn't put anything past certain factions. Nothing. The man was big. He was stark naked, and he had an erection. He walked through the hotel hallway, got to a window at the end, and stopped. The window was one of those that couldn't be opened. The man put his hands on the window and shoved. The window exploded outward. The man backed up a few steps, took a short run, and dived through the shattered window, looking like he was pretending to be Superman. Melissa Allison said, "Agent Lee?" The man who'd been introduced to Michaels as Brett Lee of the Drug Enforcement Administration shut off the Infocus projector and his laptop computer, and the image of the broken window faded. "This was taken by security cameras in the new Sheraton Hotel in Madrid," he said. "The man was Richard Aubrey Barnett, age 30, whose internet company earned him $14 million last month. He fell 28 stories." Michaels said, "I see, and this is related to the casino owner who trashed his competitor's place of business before being killed by local police?" "Yes." "And to the woman who attacked a gang of construction workers who whistled at her and put seven of them into intensive care?" "Yes," Lee said, "and to others of a similar nature." "And I take it that since you are DEA, you think drugs were somehow involved." Lee frowned, not sure if Michaels was pulling his chain or not, which Michaels had to admit to himself he was, a little. Lee seemed awfully stiff. Lee said, "Yes, we are certain of that." Michaels nodded. "Please don't take offense, Mr. Lee, but this concerns NetForce how?" Lee looked at Allison for support and got it. She said, "My counterpart at DEA has asked for our assistance. Naturally, the FBI and any of its subsidiaries are happy to help in any way we can." "Naturally," Michaels said, knowing full well that interagency cooperation was more often like competing football teams. Rivalries among the dozen or so agencies that comprised the intelligence community in the U.S. were old, established. Yes, they were all technically on the same team, but practically speaking, an agency was happy to shine its own star any way it could, even if that included using another agency's shirt to do it. Michaels said, "So, how is it that NetForce can do something here DEA can't?" Lee, a short man with a fierce look, flushed. Michaels could almost see him bite his tongue to keep from saying what he really wanted to say. Instead, Lee said, "How much do you know about the drug laws, Commander Michaels?"
"Not much."
"All right, let me give you a quick and rough overview. Federal drug regulation in the United States comes under the authority of the Controlled Substances Act, that's CSA. Legal and illegal drugs are put on one of five schedules, depending on what uses have been established for them and on how much potential for abuse they have. Schedule 1 is reserved for dangerous drugs without medical applications that have a high potential for abuse. Schedule 5 is for stuff with low abuse potential."
"We're talking about the difference between, say, heroin and aspirin?"
"Precisely. The CSA gets pretty specific about these things."
"Go ahead, I'm still with you."
"In the last few years, there has been a resurgence in so-called designer drugs. That is to say, those that don't slot neatly into the traditional categories. Variations and combinations of things like MDA, ecstasy, certain new anabolic steroids like that. The government realized that certain individuals were trying to circumvent the intent of the law by adding a molecule here or subtracting one there to make a drug that wasn't technically illegal. So there is a provision for analog drugs not addressed by the code."
Michaels nodded, wondering where this was going.
"And in case we have a really clever chemist who comes up with something entirely new and different, which is pretty much unlikely, if not impossible, given the known things that humans abuse, the Attorney General can put that on Schedule 1 on an emergency basis."
Michaels nodded again.
"Very interesting. If you are a DEA agent, are we getting to a point anytime soon?"
Lee flushed.
"What it means is, we have some pretty specific tools we can use to get dangerous illegal drugs off the street, but in this case, we can't use them."
"Ah, now that was interesting.
Why not?"
"Because we haven't been able to obtain enough of the drug to analyze it properly." We know what it does. It makes you fast, strong, mean, and sexually potent. It might make you smarter, too, but that's hard to say from our samples, since if they were that smart, they ought not to be dead. We know what it looks like. It comes in a big purple capsule, but we can't make it illegal if we don't know what it is in the cap.
Michaels grinned slightly. He could hear that conversation.
Yes, sir, this is vile stuff, all right. Could you put it on the list so we can bust the guys who made it? What's in it? Well, we don't know exactly. Can't you, just make big purple capsules illegal temporarily?
And where does NetForce come in?
We have evidence that the makers of the drug, they call it Thor's hammer, by the way, are using the Internet to arrange delivery.
If the drug isn't illegal, then using the net to distribute it isn't illegal either, Michaels said.
We know, but if we can find them, we can damn well ask the miscreants making it to give us a sample, so to speak.
Miscreants? Michaels didn't think he'd ever actually heard that word used in a conversation before. Pardon me for asking a stupid question, but wouldn't it be easier just to buy some on the street and analyze it?
Believe it or not, Commander, that thought did occur to us, it being our job and all. It isn't a common street drug. The cost of it is extremely high, and the sellers are very selective about whom they sell it to. So far, none of our agents have been able to make a connection. We did manage to seize one capsule after the death of one of the people that we know took the drug. Unfortunately, the chemist in this case is very clever. By the time we got the stuff to our lab and analyzed, the active ingredients had all been somehow rendered inert. There is some kind of timing mechanism in the drug. If you don't use it fairly quickly, it turns into a bland, inert powder that doesn't do anything but sit there.
You can't tell what the drugs were?
Our chemists can infer what they were, sure. There are residues, but we can't document for certain what the exact precursor drugs and percentages of each were because they are essentially gone.
Huh. That must be frustrating.
Sir, you do not know the half of it. The common thread running through all the sudden insanities is money. Every one of the 12 people we feel certain died as a result of having ingested this drug is, or was, rich.
Ah.
Michaels understood that. You might lean on a criminal street pusher, threaten him, rough him up a little to get what you wanted from him, but millionaires tended to come equipped with herds of lawyers. Cops tended to walk with more care. Rich people had recreations denied to the common folk.
Precisely. So, until we can get a sample before the enzyme is added, or get to one fast enough to beat the decomposition, we're stuck. We need your help.
Michaels nodded. Maybe the guy wasn't that bad, and things around NetForce were as slow as he had ever seen them.
All right, Mr. Lee, we'll see if we can't run your dope dealers to ground.
Thank you.
Washington, D.C. Tony smiled at the UPS man as he left, then took the latest packages into the garage. Alex had told her she could have half the workbench, and she had already started putting her stuff there. So far, she had the magnifying lamp set up, the alcohol burner and wax cauldron, a couple tubes of lamp black oil paint, and some rags and cleaning supplies. The new packages should have the pin vises, some assorted sewing needles, lens paper and lanolin hand cleaner, and a couple of X-Acto knives and some blades, plus the jeweler's special wax and some polishing compound. She already had some old piano keys. She didn't need the buffing wheels. Alex had a Dremel tool that would work. And while the stereo microscope like the one her teacher used was really neat, she couldn't justify spending $800 or $900 on it, not unless she got to the point where she was selling pieces, which would probably not ever happen. Tony had never thought of herself as having much artistic talent, but according to Bob Hergert's online VR class, while being a world-class artist wouldn't hurt, it wasn't absolutely necessary. Given the wonders of the modern computer age, there was a lot technique could do to make up for talent. She opened the packages, removed the tools and supplies, and set them out. She had some ideas of what she might like to try first, and for that she needed to go back to her computer. There were lots of places to find pictures in the public domain. She sighed. Before she sat down at the computer and went shopping online, she needed to go pee again. And that, she understood, was not going to get better as her pregnancy progressed, but worse. She sure hoped having Alex's son was worth all this aggravation. Normally, John Howard ran at the base or around the Net Force compound, but today he felt like taking a tour of his own neighborhood. It was warm for early October and muggy, so he wore running shorts and a tank top, though he did have a fanny pack holding his Virgil, his ID, and a small handgun, a little Seacamp 380 double-action auto. Howard started to jog up the street. Though he was only in his very early 40s, he could remember a time when a lone black man running through the streets of Washington, D.C. would have been cause for a local cop to stop him on general principles. What his daddy used to call a BANIB violation, being a nigger and breathing. Now there were as many black folks, African Americans, the politically correct like to say, as there were whites in his neighborhood. Sure, there were still racists, probably always would be, but not as many as once there were. The leaves were falling. They'd all be down by Halloween. First good wind that came along any time now would finish them. And while the sun was warm, there was that subtle difference between spring and fall, that sense of impending winter. He passed old man Carlson working in his yard. The old man, 80 if he was a day, smiled and waved. Tyrone had called today from his class trip to Canada. He was going to be gone for another 10 days on a visit for his international relations class. Howard thought it was a good idea, getting to know other cultures. Better than learning it the Army's way. He smiled, remembering the old slogan his first top kick had posted over his desk when he'd first joined up. Join the Army and see the world. Travel to exotic, unusual locales. Learn about other cultures. Meet diverse and interesting people. And kill them. He picked his pace up a little, stretching out, getting into a longer stride and rhythm. The scars were formed up pretty good where he'd had surgery after the shooting in Alaska. Pretty much nothing hurt most of the time, but the memories hadn't faded at all. Being out in the middle of nowhere, exchanging gunfire with some real bad men, almost dying, those kinds of memories didn't go away in a few months. And the thought that he might have bled to death in the woods and been eaten by scavengers wasn't so horrifying in itself. Hell, he was a professional soldier. Getting killed went with the territory. But dying and leaving his son, just hitting his teens on his way to manhood, that bothered Howard more than it ever had. And while he wasn't afraid to go into battle, at least he didn't think so, he didn't want to die and leave his wife and son. They had become more precious to him when he'd realized he might lose them. He believed in the kingdom of heaven, and he tried to live his life in a moral and upright manner, but going there wasn't at the top of his to-do list for this year. He could, Howard knew, become an armchair general, a Rempf who directed operations at a distance. Net Force would prefer it that way, and probably nobody would think the less of him for it. But sending a man somewhere he wasn't willing to go himself didn't seem right. Never had. That left the other option, which was to retire. He could muster out with his current rank of general, draw a fair retirement, and get a job consulting somewhere, teaching, whatever. Probably do better money-wise than he was doing now, and be a lot more certain of being around when his son graduated from high school, from college, got married, and brought home grandchildren. Sure, that was 10-15 years away, maybe, but he didn't want to miss it, and he didn't want to leave Nadine. But he was a soldier. A professional warrior. This was what he did, who he was, and he liked it. So he had to puzzle this out. It was important. Not easy, maybe, but something he had to do. He picked up his pace again. Run, John. Think later. Malibu, California. Tad Burshaw drove back to the beach house. Poking along, in no hurry now. He had made his deliveries, collected the money, and decided what the hell and taken the purple cab half an hour ago. It would be another few minutes before it started to come on full force, but even now he was getting patterns, geometric overlays of complicated pulsing grids on everything. That was from the psychedelic components of the drug. It made driving real interesting. Bobby was cagey about his chem. He never told anybody exactly what was in it. But Burshaw had sampled enough illegal stuff over the years to have some pragmatic knowledge about such things. There was some kind of MDMA ecstasy analog in the Hammer's alloy, with maybe a bit of mescaline. The body rushes got pretty intense an hour or so in, and just breathing was orgasmic when it got to circulating. The psychedelics, entheogens, Bobby called those, gave you that sense of being in contact with your inner self and loving the world and all. Also picked up the sensory input, made everything feel really, really intense. It had smart drugs in it, he knew that, because he was quicker, sharper, able to make choices better when the Hammer was at full pound, no question. For sure it had some kind of speed, some trank to balance it so you got the fast mind but not bad jitters. It definitely had painkiller in it, or a way to kick in the body's own opiates, and Tad guessed some kind of animal trank and steroid mix. And something like Viagra was in it, too, because it gave you a hard-on that wouldn't quit. The Zeister once took 6 women to bed while tripping, and none of them could walk the next day. Supposedly made women horny, too. Past that, Bobby definitely had some secret ingredients about which Tad knew zip. He knew what they did to him, but not why or how. The total combination was synergistic. That meant more than the sum of its parts. And the bottom line was, it didn't really matter how it did what it did, only that it did do it. He took a deep breath, and chills frosted him all over, despite the still warm late afternoon Santa Ana wind blowing in through the open window. Whew, what a rush. 17 times he had swung Thor's hammer, and not once a bad trip. 17 times he had practically turned into a superhuman. Stronger, faster, smarter, pain-free, fatigue-free, a guy who could walk into the local kung fu school and kick its collective ass. And, oh, yeah, there was the sex, though that never seemed to call to him much. Yeah, he got the iron woody and all, but he never seemed to have time to put it into anybody. Too much else to do to lie down and be still, or relatively still. Though right at the moment he felt pretty mellow, the desire to shuck the car and get physical was ahead, he knew. Another rush enveloped him, and he was glad the house wasn't too far away. It wasn't that he couldn't maintain control during the early stages of the trip, but it took too much effort, and he didn't want to waste effort on piddly shit. Washington, D.C. Michaels was almost home and wishing he was already there. What he had in mind was a nice, cold beer, his bare feet propped up to watch the news hour, maybe falling asleep on the couch. He was tired. It had been a long day, made longer because it was dull and mostly uninteresting. He was only a mile or so away from home when his Virgil came to life. He was tempted to ignore it, but it might be Tony, so he pulled the device from his belt and looked at the ID sig. It was blank. Michaels frowned. FBI comm watchware was supposed to circumvent any commercial ID blocker, so the only people who could reach out and touch him at this number without him knowing who they were would have to be somebody with federal-level blockers. He thumbed the connect button. Yes?
Commander Michaels, this is Zachary George with the National Security Agency. I hope I'm not interrupting your dinner.
The tiny screen was blank.
Not yet. What can I do for you, Mr. George?
Oops. Can you hold on a second? I have another call. This was not true, but it gave Michaels a few seconds to key in a trace, which he did.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Sir, we understand your agency is involved in a joint investigation with the DEA. We'd like to speak to you about this, if we could.
You can set up an appointment with my assistant, Mr. George, although I'm not sure why NSA would have any interest in such a thing if it was so, and I wouldn't confirm it over the comm in any event.
The incoming diode lit. That would be his trace. He tapped it, and a number scrolled up on the view screen with an ID. George Zachary, National Security Agency. Well, at least that much was true.
I understand your reluctance, sir, and I will be happy to explain it all to you when I see you. Ah, I see you've traced the call and confirmed my ID. Excellent. I'll be contacting your assistant for an appointment at your earliest convenience, sir. Thank you. Discount.
He went away. Michaels frowned again. What did NSA want with the drug investigation? And why was their stealthware better than the FBI's, to know they had been traced? He was going to have to talk to Jay about that. He dropped the Virgil onto the seat and shook his head. 2 more blocks to go. Beer, couch, television. Soon. Not that easy, of course. When he walked in, Tony was all aglow over her new hobby. So, of course, he had to go into the garage and admire her toys. Well, what the hell? It made her happy. That made him happy. With all the mood swings lately, any time she was smiling was good. Better make the most of it. He listened with half an ear. When she ran down, he smiled. She couldn't drink, given her pregnancy and all, but maybe she could take some vicarious pleasure out of watching him enjoy a cold one. "Not yet," she said.
"Huh?"
"You need to do your jurus." Michaels wanted to say a bad word, but he wisely refrained. Tony wasn't just his wife, but also his silat teacher. "It takes a few thousand repetitions to get the moves down, Alex. Latest scientific research I read says somewhere in the 50 to 100-hour range." He did the math.
"So for 18 jurus, I need to practice for 900 to 1,800 hours before I get them? At 30 minutes a day, that works out to about 180 hours a year, so we're talking about 10 years?
Well, to get them really smooth, it'll take maybe another 5 years.
I'll be retired by then."
"Good. Give you more time to practice."
He laughed. "You are a slave driver."
He went to the bedroom, shucked his street clothes, and put on a pair of sweats and T-shirt. As he was doing spinal twists, Tony wandered back in from the garage.
"So, how was your day?"
Given that she had been his assistant and knew as much about his work as he did, it was natural for her to ask, and just as natural for him to tell her.
"Dead calm, except for a flurry at the end with a kid hacker posting porno."
"Oh, boy, and me here missing it all."
"Well, there were a couple of things mildly interesting."
He told her about the drug stuff and about the cryptic call from the NSA guy. She watched him, said, "Keep your back straight when you turn. So what does Jay say about tracking down the dope dealer?"
"He said it was going to be a bitch. Apparently drug sales over the Internet have always been a problem. Back in the early days, a lot of it was technically illegal, but not prosecuted."
"How so?"
"Well, suppose you were 70 years old and living on Social Security in North Dakota or maybe South Texas. If you got sick and needed medicine, a prescription might cost, say, $50 a bottle. Suppose you had to take 2 or 3 bottles a month for years. That could cut way into your food budget. So you'd hop a bus to Canada or to Mexico, where the same drug might cost $16 or $18. A local doc writes you a script based on your existing one from the U.S., and even with $20 for that, you still come out way ahead in the long run."
"Yeah?"
"So with the net and cheap home computers or access through cable TV or whatever, you don't even have to take the bus ride. You log onto a site, order what you need, and your prescription shows up in your mailbox in a day or two, assuming you are dealing with a reputable outfit."
"So the DEA didn't leap all over these folks for importing medicine illegally?"
"Think about that for a second. Here's somebody's little old granny on a pension who's got a bad heart after working 40 years teaching grammar school kids. Would you want to be the DEA guy in charge of arresting her for buying her nitroglycerin or whatever across the border to save enough money so she doesn't have to eat dog food? Imagine how many federal prosecutors would want to hop on that career bandwagon. The press would swarm you like a cloud of starving locusts. Can't you just see the headlines? Grandma busted for heart meds."
"It could be a political problem."
"Oh, yeah, it could. Then there are the drugs that are legal in other countries but not approved by the FDA, which, according to Jay, is another whole can of worms. Let's say you want to take Memoryl, one of the new smart drugs that improves your short-term memory, something like 70%. The FDA is still out on that one, but it's been legal in most of Europe for a couple of years. So you log onto a web page in Spain, give them your credit card number, and order 100 tabs. If customs happens to guess what's in the package, they'll confiscate it, because technically it is illegal, but it's a gray area. If you went to Spain and got the stuff from a doctor there, you could bring it home for your own personal use. What's the difference if it comes by mail or you carried it home in your pocket? It's malum prohibitum, illegal because it's illegal, not malum in se, bad in itself."
"When did you start speaking Latin?"
"Since I asked our lawyers about all this. And then we get to the illegal stuff, which is easier to prosecute, assuming you know what it is and know for sure that it is illegal, which is the problem here. Big purple caps aren't illegal in themselves. So there you have it. It's really the FDA's problem, only the boss made it mine. She probably owes somebody over there a favor, and this is it. And the NSA listens to everything on the air or over the wire, so I can understand how they know about it, but I don't see why it should interest them. I wish you were still working. We all miss you at the office. Me, most of all.
You're loose enough. Up. Do your jurus. You'll feel better after you work out.
He came to his feet. That was true. He almost always did feel better afterward. It was the damned inertia that was so hard to overcome sometimes. Good that he had Tony here to prod him, among her other many virtues.
Malibu, California. Naked, Drain padded into the kitchen to get the rest of the bottle of champagne from the freezer. He really ought to get a little fridge for the bedroom, save him a walk. Life was so hard. Not that the girl would miss him. What was her name? Misty? Bunny? Buffy? Something like that. He'd say honey and call it good. She was out, and she ought to sleep pretty hard, too, given the athletic encounters and the first bottle of bubbly they'd just split. She was an actress. All of them were. Early 20-something, tight, fit, perky. A natural redhead, he had discovered, to his delight. He'd picked her up at the gym, which is where he found most of the girls he brought home. Jocks tended to be fitter, had less risk of disease, and were able to play longer. It never took long for him to make a connection with one. He wasn't bad-looking, and the drop-top Mercedes two-seater usually impressed him. He even had some business cards that said he was an independent movie producer, Bobby D. Productions, and that would usually be enough to clinch the contact. As he turned from the hallway toward the kitchen, he saw Tad standing on the beach, staring at the ocean. Drain shook his head. Tad rode the hammer, crazy fucker that he was. It was going to kill him someday, no question. He was in such crappy shape, it was a miracle it hadn't killed him already. A night running with Thor was worth a week's recovery for somebody in pretty good physical condition, maybe more. Tad ought not to be able to recover at all, and yet he had swung the hammer more than anybody alive and somehow managed to keep breathing. Of course, Tad had a portable pharmacy he gobbled, snorted, or shot up after he came off a hammer trip. Probably more drugs than blood circulating in him at any given time. Somehow, he had managed to stay a step ahead of the Reaper. Pretty damn amazing. Drain opened the freezer, pulled a second bottle of champagne out. He lifted it to his lips, thought better about that, and grabbed one of the chilled glasses on the freezer rack. Drinking it from the bottle was for barbarians. The bubbles didn't get released. Had to be civilized about this, didn't we? He poured the icy wine into the icy glass, watched the liquid turn to foam and fountain up, then slowly began to settle down. Out on the beach near the waterline, three hulking big jocks ran past. Drain glanced at Tad, worried. If Tad decided he didn't like the way the guys looked, he'd go for them. But the trio jogged past, and if Tad even saw them, Drain couldn't tell it from here. He shook his head. Sooner or later, Tad was going to step wrong and draw the law's attention. It had been a while since he'd done it last, and fortunately it hadn't led back to Drain that time. Plus, the house was clean. He never kept anything illegal on hand for longer than it took to mix it and get it out again. But he didn't need the local deputies knocking on his door and asking about the crazy asshole dressed in black who suddenly turned into the Incredible Hulk and laid waste to the beach. Low profile was the way to go. If they didn't know about you, they wouldn't be able to bother you. He finished filling up the glass and put the bottle back into the freezer. He walked to the deck, sipping at the cold champagne. Yeasty with a hint of apple, good finish, no bitter aftertaste. He grinned. He sure had a lot to complain about, didn't he? Living in a big house on the beach in Malibu, good-looking naked woman in his bed, a shitload of money. Hell, it really didn't get much better than that, did it? Tad felt the power. It coursed through him like an electric current, set him humming like a dynamo. He was a god out here, deciding the fate of all who passed. At his whim, he could strike them down. At his whim, which was how gods operated, far as he could tell. He took a breath, and the sensation made orgasm seem pale in comparison. The thrills ran through his entire body. He could feel it everywhere at once, in his hands, his body, even his toes. Man, what a rush. He was a god, able to do anything he wished. He was aware of everything, not just on this beach, but radiating out to galaxies a billion light years from where he walked. It was all his territory, all of it. If he reached up his arms, he could encompass it all in his grasp. He laughed. He walked through his kingdom, feeling for the moment benevolent in his omnipotence. He would suffer them to live. For now, anyway. Jayland, Quantico, Virginia. Jay Gridley had always been a man who enjoyed moving fast. When he slipped into his sensory gear and the net blossomed before him, infinite in its possibilities, he had always chosen speed as his vehicle. If he drove, it was a Viper, a rocket with wheels that smoked everything else on the road. Sometimes he flew, rocket packs, jets, copters, whatever. He created virtual scenarios that he zipped through like rifle rounds, clean, fast, slick as a tub full of grease. Oh, now and then he would do period. He'd make a western town and mosey into town on a horse or a boat. But getting there in a hurry was his pleasure, and most of his programs reflected that. Not today. Today, Jet and Jay was out for a stroll through an eastern garden. The day was warm with a little breeze and the smell of jasmine and sandalwood mixed with roses and musk. Welcome to the land of the happy, nice people, Jay. Your kind of place. He smiled, walking slowly. What he wanted was here somewhere, but you know what? He would get to it when he got to it. To be honest, he hadn't exactly embraced the tenets of Buddhism, but there was an energy about what Saji did and how she related to it that he did find worth thinking about. Thanks Sojan Rinpoche for that, along with her other, more earthy talents. A bee flew past, buzzing, looking for pollen.
"Hey, Jay, you awake?"
came the somewhat dissonant voice, intruding on his scenario. Jay dropped out of VR and was at once back in his office at NetForce. Standing in the doorway were two co-workers, Alan and Charlie.
"That door is supposed to be locked," Jay said, mildly irritated. "Yep, and if you hadn't wanted somebody good enough to rascal the sucker, you'd have hired somebody other than us," Charlie said. "Come on, we're going to Pud's for burgers and beer."
Jay spoke without thinking.
"Nah, I'll pass. I'm giving up eating flesh."
Both Alan and Charlie stared for maybe 2 seconds before they cracked up.
"Flesh? Flesh, you said? Oh, yeah, I can hear that. Excuse me, ma'am, could I get a flesh burger on an onion bun?"
"Fuck off and die, you know what I mean." The two men looked at each other and shook their heads in mock sadness. Alan said,
"The man is in love. Next thing you know, he's going to be wearing a cowled robe to work and doing Gregorian chants up and down the halls. Yeah, and sprinkling rose petals everywhere."
"Go away." They did, cackling down the hall as they went. "Well, that certainly went well, didn't it? Maybe you might want to be a little bit more low-key in your conversion to vegetarianism, hmm? Too late now. By tomorrow morning, this would be all over the building." Still, he grinned. He could stand a little ribbing. He was, after all, the new, improved Jay Gridley, much more mellow than the old Jay had been. Much more. Washington, D.C. Tony came up from sleep all of a moment. She looked at the clock on the bedside table. 2 a.m., and she was wide awake, not a trace of drowsiness. Well, wasn't that terrific? What, she wondered, had awakened her? Another hormone-fueled dream she couldn't remember? She glanced at Alex, who slept soundly. Sometimes he snored, and that might do it, but he wasn't making any noise. She listened carefully, but the house was silent. No footsteps skulking down the hall. No feeling of intrusion. Was it because she needed to go pee? No, not really. She always needed to go pee these days. Still, as long as she was awake. She got up, went to the bathroom, and padded back to bed. She began practicing her jurus mentally, going through them step by step in her mind's eye. That usually would put her to sleep before she got very far along. She managed to go all the way through the 18 on the right side and was halfway through doing them on the left when the phone rang. Tony grabbed it. "Hello?"
"Tony, it's me, Mama."
Tony felt her belly twist suddenly.
"Is it Papa?" "No, dear, Papa's fine. But I'm afraid it's Mrs. DeBeers."
"Guru, what happened?"
She had a stroke about 15 minutes ago.
Tony glanced at the clock again. Exactly when she had awakened. Was this some weird coincidence? Or were she and her elderly teacher physically connected, as Guru sometimes said?
She's on the way to the hospital. She managed to reach her medical alert button, and the paramedics and ambulance woke us all up. Papa is going to the hospital with your brother. I thought you'd want to know.
Which hospital, Mama?
St. Agnes?
Thanks for calling me, Mama. I'll talk to you later. She cradled the phone. Alex was sitting up.
Who? Guru had a stroke.
How bad?
I don't know.
I'll drive you to the airport.
She blinked at him. Just like that, no question. He knew she was going.
Thank you, Alex. I love you.
I know, I love you too. I'll call and get you a flight while you get dressed.
Tony nodded. Tony had started learning the art of Pentjak Silat from the old lady when she was already past retirement age, and she was 83 now. Guru was still built like a squat brick, but even so, she was not a young woman. A stroke. Dear God. Alex was mostly quiet during the drive to the airport, though he did offer to go with her.
Nothing you can do to help?
Not her, but I can be there for you.
She smiled at him.
I knew there was a reason I married you. Keep the home fires burning. I'll call as soon as I know what's happening.
It was hard to think about Guru dying. She had been so much a part of Tony's day-to-day life from her early teenage years until she left for college. Every morning they'd practice before Tony went off to school. Every afternoon, after she had done her homework, Tony would head across the street to the old woman's place and they would practice. Guru De Beers had become part of the family, was included in all the gatherings. She had finally given up smoking that nasty old pipe, but she still drank half a gallon of coffee a day and ate whatever she pleased. And even though she was in her 80s, Guru could still give most big, strong men fits if they bothered her enough. Tony hadn't been to Mass except with Mama on home visits for a long time, but she offered a silent prayer. Please let her live. NetForce HQ, Quantico, Virginia. Michaels hadn't managed to get back to sleep after Tony left for New York, so he was a little tired. He had a partial staff meeting scheduled, and when he got there, his people were already at the conference table. John Howard, Jay Gridley, and the just-promoted Julio Fernandez. A few months ago, Fernandez's wife, Joanna, would have been there, as would Tony. He missed seeing them.
"Good morning,"
he said. "Commander," Howard and Fernandez said in unison.
"Hey, I thought it was your turn to bring the donuts, boss,"
Jay said. This was an old joke. They never ate donuts at the morning meetings.
"You didn't give up sugar when you gave up flesh," Fernandez said. "Very funny, Julio."
Michaels raised an eyebrow. Fernandez answered the unasked question.
"Our computer wizard here is turning Buddhist. No more eating flesh for him. Gonna step around ants on the sidewalk, too, I expect, chanting Om Mani Padme Hum while he does."
Michaels shook his head. "Never a dull moment around here."
"Okay, what do we have, John?"
General Howard led off with his weekly report. New gear, new troops, old business. Things were slow. Jay didn't have a lot to report either.
"Nothing on your dope dealers. The DEA's info was pretty sparse and dead-ended quick. I'll run some other things into the mix and see what comes up."
Michaels turned to Howard.
"I sent a report your way."
Howard said, "Yes, sir, I saw the report. Thor's hammer." Michaels said,
"Here's another little twist. I got a call from an NSA guy yesterday. He's made an appointment to come see me in about an hour. He says it's about this designer drug thing. I'm curious as to why."
"What's his name?" Jay asked.
"Last name George, first name Zachary."
Jay shrugged, but tapped it into his flat-screen's manual keyboard.
"Never heard of him, but I'll scope him out."
"John?" Doesn't ring any bells with me. I can check my Pentagon contacts.
Why would the National Security Agency be interested in this? Michaels asked.
Dope isn't in their mission statement, is it?
Howard said, Mission statements aren't worth the paper they are written on, sir. Everybody stretches them to fit whatever they need.
Michaels smiled. He had done that himself more than a few times, and everybody here knew it.
I suppose I can wait until the man gets here and ask him, but I somehow doubt he'll be entirely forthcoming. Anybody have any thoughts I might pursue?
Howard blew out a small sigh. Military applications?
Michaels looked at him.
If you have a compound that makes a man think he's faster than a speeding bullet and more powerful than a locomotive when you put a weapon in his hands and point him at an enemy, you could have something of military value.
Didn't the Nazis try that kind of thing?
Yes, sir, and other armies have tried it since, from speed to steroids. Nobody has come up with something cheap and dependable enough yet, but if they did, it would certainly have useful applications.
Would you use such a thing, General?
If it was safe, if it was legal, and if it would give my people an advantage over an enemy, bring more of them back alive, yes, sir, in a heartbeat.
From what the DEA has given us, this stuff is neither safe nor legal.
But it might be made both, and there are some armies with fewer scruples about testing things on their own people than we have.
Jay said, When did the U.S. military develop scruples, General? Remember, here, men, put on these goggles when you look at the nuclear explosion, and don't worry about that glowing dust if it gets on you. Just brush it off. You'll be fine.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah? What about Agent Orange in Vietnam, or the vaccines against nerve gas and biowarfare in Desert Storm, or the new, improved, supposedly safe defoliants in Colombia?
Before Howard could respond, Michael said,
Give it a rest, Jay. We didn't come to argue about the military's checkered history. And whatever happened, we can hardly blame General Howard, can we?
Jay shut up, having expressed his standing liberal attitude.
All right, if there's nothing further, I've got a ton of files to review.
45 minutes later, there was a tap at Alex's door.
Jay?
Boss, I uploaded what I could find on this George guy.
Thanks, Jay, I appreciate it.
After Jay left, Michaels found the file and read through it. Not much. Seemed Mr. George had been with NSA since leaving college 15 years ago.
Sir? Came the voice of his secretary over the comm. Your 9 o'clock is here.
Well, speak of the devil. Show him in.
Mr. George wasn't particularly impressive upon first look. Average height, average weight, brown hair cut short, fair skin, and clothes that were standard mid-level bureaucrat. Put him in a room with 4 other people and he'd be invisible.
The guy in the corner who looked totally average?
No, not him. The guy next to him. Michaels stood and extended his hand.
Mr. George?
Commander, good of you to see me.
Well, we like to keep relations good with our fellow agencies, spirit of cooperation and all.
With all due respect, sir, bullshit. Almost anybody at my agency would cut the throats of everybody at yours if they thought it would gain them 2 brownie points at review time. And that's pretty much my experience with all the security agencies I've dealt with.
Michaels had to smile at that.
Don't sugarcoat it that way. Tell me what you really think.
George returned the smile, and whatever he was up to, he was interesting.
Have a seat.
The NSA man sat.
You figured out what it is I'm up to yet?
Why don't you just tell me?
George smiled again.
Well, sir, I don't want to make it too easy for you.
Much as I'd like to fence with you, I do have a couple of other things on my plate. Talk or walk?
George nodded.
Sir, you may be aware that there are qualities connected to this drug we spoke of that might be of use to certain of our military organizations.
That thought has crossed my mind.
As it happens, my agency has a research facility engaged in studying certain pharmaceutical aids for possible use in field operations.
Really?
More information is need to know, I'm sorry. Suffice it to say, we would be very interested in speaking with the chemist who has come up with this compound when you find him.
Why aren't you talking to the DEA?
We have. Frankly, we don't think the DEA has much of a chance of catching the guy.
It is their area of expertise, isn't it?
Then why did they come to you for help?
That was a good point, but Michaels didn't speak to it. Instead, he said,
And why didn't you just go after the dealer on your own?
NSA has a finger in just about every pie there is, don't they?
True. And as a result, we are stretched somewhat thin. The bottom line is, I think you'll uncover this dealer before either the DEA or our own ops will, and we'd like you to keep us in mind when you do.
Michaels leaned back in his chair.
Even if we did, what good would it do you? DEA has jurisdiction. We turn the information over to them, they make the arrest. End of our participation.
George hesitated for a second, then said,
Of course. We wouldn't want to usurp the DEA's legal position, but a heads-up from you would allow us to begin negotiations with that agency from a position of knowledge. I'm sure we can convince them that the nation's best interests would be served if we were allowed to question the criminal before he was locked away to await a long, drawn-out trial.
Michaels smiled again. George would know this conversation was being recorded, and he didn't want to say anything that sounded remotely illegal, but George's fugue was simple. You give us the dope dealer, we rattle his cage real good and get what we want, then we turn him over to the DEA. Interesting. Michael's gut reaction was to tell Mr. Zachary George to scuttle back to his NSA hole and not let the door hit him on the way out, but he had learned a thing or two about political survival in this town.
Well, I suppose we could keep you in the loop, as a courtesy to a brother agency.
Alex wasn't going to give them squat, but he strove to leave that impression.
Why, sure, we'll scratch your back. What will you do for us?
George flashed his crooked smile again. We would appreciate it, Commander. I'm certain we can return the favor in some small way.
When and if they came across the drug dealer, then he could decide whether to let NSA know about it. Probably they wouldn't. Almost certainly not in time to do anything nasty with the knowledge. If NSA swooped in and grabbed the dope dealer from under the DEA's nose and someone figured out that it was NetForce who gave the guy up, heads would roll. Before he could get back to his reading, the intercom cheeped again.
Sir, Agent Brett Lee is here. He doesn't have an appointment, but he seems, quite insistent on seeing you.
Show him in.
Lee arrived, glowering.
What the hell is Zach George doing here?
Nice to see you too, Mr. Lee.
You didn't answer my question.
Nor do I intend to. What goes on in my office is none of your damn business.
Lee stepped forward as if he planned on doing something physical. Michaels was tired and cranky. He came to his feet, ready to move. Go for it, pal. Let me show you what my wife taught me.
But Lee stopped, having apparently realized that throwing a punch at the head of NetForce might not be a smart career move. Too bad. Michaels felt like decking him. This clown had no right storming into his office demanding anything.
You and George are up to something, and I'm warning you, it had better not get in our way. My boss will be calling yours, he said, still red-faced and angry.
I hope they have a pleasant conversation, Mr. Lee, but right now I'm busy, so if you'll excuse me, I have work to do.
In another second, Brett Lee was gone, leaving an angry wake behind him. This was a very interesting development. Much more fun than reading reports on a dull morning. Malibu, California. When Drain shuffled into the kitchen with just the tiniest headache from drinking most of 2 bottles of champagne, he saw Tad sprawled on the couch and dead to the world. Good. One of these trips Tad wasn't going to come back, but he was glad it wasn't this time. He'd miss the guy. Tad was balls to the wall and full out. Not too many like him. And loyal. You couldn't buy that. Drain opened the cabinet over the microwave oven and dug through the vitamins until he found the ibuprofen. He shook 4, swallowed them dry, and put the bottle back. There were rows and rows of vitamin bottles there. He was a big believer in such things, but he wouldn't take those until he had some food in his stomach. He took so many that doing so on an empty belly was apt to make him nauseated. His normal intake each morning amounted to maybe 20, 25 pills. Champagne was his only vice, well, unless you counted sex, and he even wore sunblock these days. He planned to live a long, rich, full life, unlike Tad, who'd be dead in a year tops, and probably a lot sooner. He'd tried to talk Tad out of them, the hammer trips, but Tad was who he was, and if he did quit, he'd turn into somebody else. Misty Bunny Buffy was gone, slipped out in the night sometime. He figured she had a steady boyfriend or a husband she had to get back to. Sleeping with a producer to maybe get a job didn't really count. He was done with her anyhow. He looked at his watch. It was almost 10 a.m. He sighed. Too late to get in a workout or a jog on the beach. Better get rolling. He had to drive out to the desert to restock his mobile lab, and it was a couple hours each way. He needed to be back by 6. He had a dinner with the Z-ster. That was always good for some laughs. He grinned. He wondered what his father would say if he knew how much money little Bobby had tucked away, or how he had earned it. The old man would blow a gasket, that was certain. 30 years with the Bureau, as straight and narrow as ever put on a suit. And for what? What had all that nose-to-the-grindstone Johnny-B-Good crap gotten his old man? It had gotten him retired to a condo in Tucson, Arizona, just him and that little terrier of his, Franklin, living on a pension and bitching about how the world had gone to hell in a handbasket. Actually, Dream kind of liked the dog. Best thing his old man had done since Mom died was get a dog. Not saying much. It had been more than a year since he had gone to visit his father. Franklin must be pushing 9 or 10 by now. Drain often wondered if his old man found out what he was doing, would he turn him in? Some days he was sure that former Special Agent in Charge Rickover Drain, R.D. to his friends, would do it, no question. Other days he wasn't so sure. Maybe the old bastard had a soft spot for his only son. Not that Drain had ever been able to see it. As far as the old man knew, Bobby worked for a small chemical company that produced plastic polymer for use in industrial waste containers, earning a decent salary, just a hair more than his father had made in his last year before retirement. This was done so the old man would think all that tuition money for the chemistry degree hadn't been wasted. Of course, that was as much for Drain's protection as for making his father proud. He had gone to some lengths to create the Polychem Products Company, duly incorporated in Delaware, to set up a modest history in a few selected computer banks, and to make sure he was listed as an employee, just in case his father checked it out. He wouldn't put it past the old man to do that. Paid taxes on the paper job salary he showed, too, and FICA and all that shit. IRS didn't care what you did as long as you paid taxes. He could have declared his income from dope sales and paid the feds their cut, and the IRS would never say anything to the DEA about it. People had done it before. The government, in whatever form it manifested, was plainly stupid. He could dick around with them all he wanted, and they'd never catch him. Drain wandered into the bathroom and cranked up the shower. It was a big sucker, room enough for 4 or 5 people, all pale green tile and glass bricks, with a dozen shower heads set all over, high, low, in between. With the jets turned on full blast, it was like being stabbed by wet needles. Used a shitload of water, but when you came out of it, you felt clean and rejuvenated. He stepped into the shower and gasped at the force of the spray. Tad would be out for probably 18 or 20 hours, maybe longer. He'd still be on the couch when Drain got back, maybe even still breathing. And he'd spend most of the next week or so on the couch, lying on the floor, or, if he made it that far, a bed. Recovering from the hammer was a chore. It got harder each time. The Bronx, New York. Tony sat in the chair next to Guru's bed, watching the old woman sleep. Mrs. De Beers had been lucky, the doctor told her. The stroke was mild, and she was in otherwise remarkable good health for an 83-year-old woman. There was only a slight effect on her grip and speech, and they expected she'd make a full recovery. The doctors only told her that because Guru had listed her as next of kin, even though that wasn't true. Tony was more than a little relieved. Guru De Beers had been a part of her life since Tony had seen her, at age 65, clean the clocks of 4 neighborhood toughs who tried to give her a hard time. Even at 13, Tony had known she did not want to be at the mercy of some man. The training in Pentjak Silat had been a part of Tony's world ever since.
"Ah, how is my Tunanganya today?"
Tony smiled. Best girl.
"I'm fine, Guru. How are you feeling?" "I felt worse. Better, too. It would be nice to have some coffee."
"The doctors won't let you do that, not after a stroke."
"I have outlived 3 sets of doctors so far. I will outlive this set if they wait for coffee to kill me. And if it does kill me, at least I die happy."
Tony smiled and reached into her purse. She brought out a small stainless steel thermos. The old woman's smile was radiant, if a trifle saggy on the left side.
Ah, you are a dutiful student.
It's not fresh. I didn't have time to go by your place and grind your grandnephew's beans and make it. I got it at Starbucks more than an hour ago. I'm sorry.
Guru shrugged. It will do. Raise the bed.
Tony operated the controls, then poured the coffee into the thermos's cup and passed it over. Guru inhaled deeply through her nose.
Espresso?
Of course. The darkest they had.
Thank you, my best girl.
Guru took a small sip.
Not bad, not bad. And how is our baby doing?
Fine. Mostly he elbows me in the bladder.
Yes, they do that. Wait until you are 8 or 9 months along, and he kicks you so hard your pants fall down.
There's a pleasant thought.
You are worried because you cannot train.
Tony shook her head. How could she know exactly what was going through her mind?
I had 4 children, all after I began my training. Each time, I had to alter my practice.
So I'm discovering.
You can do juru-juru sitting down. Your lankas will need to be sharpened, but there is no reason to stop upper body movements.
Tony nodded. The Indonesian martial art forms were divided into 2 parts, upper body, or jurus, and lower body, or lankas. You usually lumped them together and called the whole thing a juru, though that was not technically correct.
I have some things in my house for you to take home with you when you go.
Before Tony could protest, Guru continued,
No, it is not my time yet, and I am not giving you your legacy before I go. These are merely things I think you will enjoy and that I no longer have a need for.
Thank you, Guru.
I am proud of you as a student and as a woman, best girl. I expect I will live long enough to cuddle your child.
Quantico, Virginia. The woman was young, maybe 22, 23, and dressed in jeans, a black T-shirt, and running shoes. The woman approached an automated bank teller, put in her card, and stood back. Apparently, there was some malfunction. The woman smiled, then, without preamble, drove her fist through the teller's vidscreen. Shattered glass flew, and even before it finished falling, the woman was grabbing at a garbage basket on the sidewalk and hammering at the teller, smiling all the while. Alex Michaels leaned back in the chair and said,
There's something you don't see every day.
Jay Gridley said, Actually, it happens quite a lot. According to bureau agents I've talked to, although the level of violence is usually much less, people tend to spit at the screen or slam it with the edge of their fist once or twice. Nobody's ever seen one quite this, active before.
What happened after she trashed the video cam recording it?
According to witnesses, she really got pissed off, whereupon she somehow managed to rip the machine free of its mountings, scattering several $1,000s and $20 bills all over the sidewalk. A small riot ensued as concerned citizens sought to, recover the money for the bank.
The boss laughed. I bet. How much of it was turned in?
About 15%.
Well, at least there are still a few honest citizens left. Why is this more special than the others?
The woman is Mary Jane Kent.
Related to the arms and chemical companies, Kent's?
Yes, sir. She's the Secretary of Defense's daughter.
Oh, my.
Jay nodded. She beat the crap out of 4 of LAPD's finest before she ran out of steam. A doctor happened along during the struggle and sedated her with a hypo full of enough thorazine to knock out a large horse, and it slowed her down, but not completely. She isn't talking about what drug she took or where she got it, but she was apparently on a shopping trip, and she used her credit card until it maxed out. That was why the bank machine wouldn't give her any cash.
Just how much does a billionaire's daughter have to spend to max out a credit card?
Enough to buy a yacht and an island to sail it to. If we can backtrack her and find out how and where she spent her money, the DEA guy you sicked on me says they are willing to put more bodies on the street to check everything out. It's not much, but it's what we have.
Michaels nodded.
Jay gave Michaels a 2-finger Cub Scout salute and headed for his office. Michael's comm chirped, and the caller ID signal told him Tony was trying to reach him. He grabbed the headset.
Hey.
Hey.
How's Guru doing?
Doctor says she's going to be all right. I'll be catching a shuttle back this afternoon. I should be home when you get there.
Great. You want me to stop and pick up something for supper?
No, we can just call the Chinese place when you get home, if that's okay.
I miss you. Fly safe.
I will. See you tonight. She hung up, and he blew out a relieved sigh. Sir, you have a call from Richard Sharon on line 5. He's the president and CEO of Merit Wells Pharmaceuticals. Michaels blinked. Why would the head honcho at one of the world's largest drug companies be calling him?
Oh.
Man, somebody wanted this stuff bad. Probably get a call from the Food and Drug Administration next.
This is Commander Alex Michaels. How can I help you, Mr. Sharon?
But he was pretty sure he already knew.
Los Angeles, California. The gag came to Bobby as he was driving back from the desert. A year or so ago, he had concocted about a quarter kilo of something he called GD, short for giggle dust. At the time, he'd had a customer interested in it, but something must have happened, and he'd stuck it into a drawer in the RV and completely forgotten about it. When he'd been there today, talking to Ma and Pa Yeehaw, who actually were married and from Missouri, he happened to open that drawer, and son of a bitch, look it, there it was. 8 ounces of the gray-green powder, worth an easy $4,000 if he wanted to bother with it. Free money. GD was a blend of MMDA, an analog of MDA or ecstasy, some psilocybin, and a little dexedrine. Everybody didn't react to it in the same way, of course, but in most people it tended to make for a really happy trip, laughing, giggling, speeding their asses off, beaming at everybody, and having a fun time in general. The gag would take all the GD he had, but what the hell? If you couldn't have fun, why bother? He had precursor for another batch of the hammer. He already had orders for $15,000 or so lined up, and probably another $5,000 or $8,000 would be in by the time he got ready to mix. Money wasn't a problem. He had money to burn. The more he thought about it, the better he liked it. So he might be late for his dinner with his Z-ster. No big deal. Z was going to be out of it anyway if he'd swung the hammer last night. And he was usually late even when he was straight. Drain grinned. Yeah, he was going to do it. 30-40 minutes, he'd be pulling up next to the federal building. He'd been there enough times when his old man had still been protecting the Republic. The building was the home of the Los Angeles office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Oh, yeah. This was going to be a hoot, all right. Malibu. Still hardly able to move, Tad managed to sit up on the couch to stare at Bobby. There weren't many days when he thought Bobby was crazier than he was. This was one of them.
You're shitting me. Nope. You blew $4,000 worth of giggle dust to stone fucking FBI HQ in L.A.?
Yep.
You're friggin' nuts, Bobby. I'd have spent that much more to have been a fly on the wall. See all those uptight fuckheads laughing and holding hands and being in tune with the universe and all? Jeez, Bobby, you have to let that go. They are just doing their jobs, you know?
You don't know what you're talking about, Tad.
Yeah, okay. How'd you pull it off?
Easy. They got great security, but I went in to fill out an application for a job on the floor above them. Got out to the roof, up to the air conditioners, found the right vents, moved a couple of filters, voila! The air is full of magic.
$4,000 for a practical joke.
The conversation sat still for a moment.
Okay, funny, but you're still a crazy motherfucker.
So who's arguing with that?
Jesus. So how is the Z-ster?
Probably as burned out as you are, he didn't show. How you holding up?
Oh, I've been worse.
You want something to eat?
No, not yet. Maybe in a day or two. I'll just pop a few pills.
Keep it up, Tad. Pretty soon nothing short of Tana leaves is going to bring you back.
Karis the Mummy with Boris Karloff.
Like half the people in L.A., Tad was an old movie buff. He especially loved those old black-and-white Universal monster pictures.
Well, at least part of your brain still works. I'm going to get some champagne. You want some? And rot my liver? Shit.
Bobby laughed. I'm going to miss you, Tad.
I know, but that was always in the cards, man. Always in the cards.
Hemp Hill, Texas. Jay Gridley hiked down a country road not far from the Toledo Bend Reservoir on the Sabine River, just across the state line from Louisiana, a place he had once visited as a child. Longleaf pine and red dirt and lazily buzzing flies completed the summer scene. Just ahead, a white-haired old man in a dirty T-shirt and overalls, no shoes, sat in the shade of a tall pine tree and whittled on a long stick with a Barlow jackknife. Jay liked to get the small details right in his scenario work.
"Howdy," Jay said.
"Howdy yourself," the whittler said.
In RW, the real world, Jay was querying a server for information that would be downloaded into his computer spool, but in VR it was much more interesting.
"What's happening?"
"Not much," the whittler allowed. "You heard about them FBI guys got poisoned?"
"Stoned," Jay said. "Not poisoned." He smiled. Yep, that had been a funny one, especially since the L.A. incident hadn't hurt anybody, only embarrassed them. "Anybody come through selling snake oil lately?" In this case, snake oil was a representation of the mysterious purple cap the DEA was all hot to run down. And not just them, so it seemed. Along his way, Jay had stopped to chat with several local characters, and so far he hadn't turned up anything. But this time, it was different.
"Well, yes, sir. There was this fella come through a little while ago, had some of that stuff, I do believe."
Jay's laid-back Zen attitude vanished.
"What? When? Which way did he go?"
"He headed on up the road over towards Hemp Hill, I reckon."
"Was he walking?"
"In a horse-drawn wagon."
Speed. He needed to get moving if he was going to track and run down the dope dealer. He looked around. He could drop out of this scenario and switch to another, or do it in RT with Voxax or a keyboard. No, wait. He had a toggle he could use, a backup. He did it, and suddenly there was a moped leaning against a tree just there.
"Mind if I borrow the bike?"
"Yep, yourself."
Jay ran to the moped, essentially a heavy bicycle with a motor that you started by pedaling the bike. He hopped on the moped and started pedaling. This contemplative Buddhist stuff was all well and good, but when things started to break, you needed to be able to move. Washington, D.C. Michaels was moving some small boxes Guru had sent home with Tony when he came across a small, highly polished wooden one that gleamed even under the dust.
"Very nice," he said, holding it up.
Tony came over to where Michaels stood and took the box from him, flipped the brass catch up and opened the lid, then turned it to show him.
"Wow," he said.
She removed a pair of small knives from velvet-lined recesses in the box. They were all metal, and the pommel end of each consisted of a thick circle with a big hole in the middle. With a quick move, Tony brought her hands together. When she pulled her hands apart, each one wore a knife, with short and nasty-looking curved blades extending point forward, maybe 2 inches from the little finger sides of her palms. Her forefingers went through the rings on the end.
"These are variations on karambits, sometimes called lawi dalam, Indonesian close-quarter knives."
She turned her hand over and palms up to show him. He took a closer look. The things were short, maybe 5 or 6 inches long, and most of that was the flat handle and hole in it. The cutting hooks themselves looked like little talons. The steel had an intricate pattern of lines and whorls in it.
"The traditional ones are usually longer and sharp on both edges. Guru had these made for her by a master knifesmith and martial artist, a guy named Steve Rollert. See, you put your forefinger through the hole and grip it so. You can also turn it around and use your little finger with the blade coming out on the thumb side. The blades are extremely sharp, and you can hit with the ring end without hurting your finger."
"Great."
She missed the sarcasm, or more likely ignored it.
"Aren't they?"
She did a little series of moves, whipping the two knives back and forth. A slight error, and there was going to be blood everywhere, his or hers. He took half a step back.
"They aren't very long."
"Because they are slashers, rather than stabbers. All the major peripheral arteries are fairly close to the skin surface. Carotids, antecubitals, femorals, popliteals. These will reach all of those. Cut a big artery and you bleed out pretty quick if you don't do something. Kill you quicker than not breathing will, and blood is a lot harder to replace than air."
"How nice."
She waved the knives again, getting into it. It was spooky to watch those things blur as she whipped them around. Michaels shook his head. His darling bride, carrying his unborn son,
was a mistress of death and destruction. You can do your jurus holding one of these in each hand, and with only a slight adjustment, do them the same.
Yeah, and slice off my nose if I make a mistake.
Better your nose than some other extremity, she grinned. Don't worry. By the time you know all 18 jurus, you'll be able to use these or a longer knife or a stick, no problem. Might nick yourself if you get sloppy, but as long as you keep proper form, you won't. Silat is weapons-based, remember? Only use your hands if nothing better is available. She waved the little knives back and forth, crossing and uncrossing her hands in patterns that looked damn dangerous to him. But she was excited, and as upbeat as he'd seen her lately, and he liked seeing that. She put the knives back into their little velvet nests. I feel better. Now I can go back and finish sorting my shoes. She handed him the box. Put these somewhere we won't forget them, and I'll show you how to play with them when we get a chance. He smiled at the wooden box and went to put it on a shelf in the living room. It would make a great conversation piece at a dinner party, or a conversation stopper, depending on what you wanted to do. Quantico, Virginia. Michaels had left the director's office, feeling a nagging sense of unease. Director Melissa Allison had ostensibly called him in for a progress report, but the real reason was, he was sure, that she had been given the word to light a fire under his ass. Even though it was the DEA's problem, had almost nothing to do with computers, and NetForce was just helping out, if they didn't do something pretty quick, it could get ugly. A couple more millionaires going bonzo, and the powers that be would be looking for a scapegoat to roast. As he got back to his own office at NetForce HQ, he saw Jay Gridley standing in the door, grinning.
Tell me you have good news, Jay.
Oh, yeah. I think I got a solid lead on our dope dealer.
Really?
Yes, sir, boss.
How?
The rich man's daughter? I backtracked her spending spree. Somebody remembered that she used a public computer in one of the shops for some kind of online transaction. I sieved the computer she might have operated, found all the email for the time she would have been in the shop, and did some cross-references and keyword hits in case she used a phony name, which, by the way, she did.
Go on, impress me.
I had the search bots looking for a long list of pointers, about 40 keys, including Thor, Thor's hammer, and all like that. I got a hit on one and followed it up.
And this keyword was?
Purple.
Purple?
As in the color of the caps. Here's the email I ran down. He handed Michaels a hard copy print. It said, Yo, Friday girl, I'll have that purple thingy for you when you come by. It was signed Wednesday.
No offense, Jay, but this is a reach. A purple thingy? It could be some kind of plush kid's toy for all we know. And days of the week as code names? Why would that be our rich woman and her dealer?
Jay grinned. That's the key, boss. Friday was named for the Norse goddess Frigga. Wednesday comes from Woden, which, as I'm sure you must know, is the way the Norse in the southern countries spelled Odin.
Fascinating. So?
Frigga and Odin were Thor's mom and pop.
Ah. That would seem to be a bit of a coincidence, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'd say so. Doesn't mean it's the chemist himself, but I bet this Wednesday guy has something to do with this drug.
Good work, Jay.
I didn't spook the guy. Stayed well back, but I can run him down to an eddy.
Better still.
Well, the thing is, this is good and bad. If I found it, the NSA people will find it too if they haven't already.
How do you figure?
Well, their mission is to monitor communications outside the U.S. for possible terrorist activity, assorted plots and things that would be good for us to know in general. So they have a whole list of words which, if they came up in a telephone conversation, a comm radio, telegraph signal, or email, stuff like that, it kicks in a recorder. The message is taped and downloaded into one of a shitload of mainframes NSA operates and rescanned, then routed to a computer program that reads the message and assigns it a priority code on a scale of 1 to 10. Anything above 5 gets sent to a human.
All right, I know this, in general, about NSA. So?
So, you think NSA confines its eyes and ears to outside our borders? Shit. If they are as hot to run down these dopers as the DEA, they would have assigned anything having to do with Thor a high priority. If we want to beat him to this Wednesday, we better get somebody on the street PDQ. The dealer might get taken, and that'd be good, but it's better for us if we get some credit, right?
Right. Let me step into my office and make a call. Thanks, Jay.
Info is in your infile under the name Rich Girl. Remember me when you give out the bonuses.
Malibu, California. When Tad woke up again, he looked at his watch. Not so much for the time as for the date. Sometimes after a hammer trip, he would be more or less unconscious for 3 or 4 days. He had been awake a couple times before to go pee and get some water and pain pills, and he thought he remembered Bobby telling him a story about stoning FBI HQ in L.A. Maybe that had been a dream. Make more sense if it was. Not too bad if the watch was right, only a couple days since he'd crashed. He hurt all over. It was like he'd been dropped off a tall building. He managed to roll to a sitting position, then up to his feet. He swayed there for a moment, fought for balance, then headed for the shower. He managed to achieve the bathroom without falling. He stripped, then got into the shower and cranked the water up full blast from all the nozzles. Halfway to using all the hot water in the house, and that was saying something, Bobby stuck his head into the steamed-up bathroom and yelled, "Still alive? Amazing."
"Fuck you."
"You okay enough to work?"
"I'm up, aren't I?"
He shut off the water and stepped out, grabbed one of the beach-sized towels and started drying off. Bobby watched him, shaking his head.
"You look like hammered dog shit."
"Why, thank you."
"Business is picking up. I got 12 orders I need to send out today, 8 more tomorrow, and 4 more the day after that."
"Got me a cap for the first run?"
"Jesus, Tad, you do want to die, don't you?"
Tad didn't answer, but finished toweling off. Bobby blew out a sigh.
"Yeah, I got one for you."
Tad nodded, managed a grin. He'd never gone riding with Thor twice in a week before. It always took a long time to recover completely. But with enough chemical assistance, he could get past the aches and injuries he collected while tripping. Thing was, he'd built up a pretty good tolerance to Demerol and morphine over the years. Getting addicted wasn't a problem he worried about, and he used morphine or smack sometimes when it got really bad, but only as a painkiller, not for the high. Some people liked downers, which was what the opiates were. Tad liked uppers. Being able to move, to do things. The months he'd spent in bed coughing up bloody sputum when he had active TB never left him. He didn't plan to die in bed. Live fast, die young, and if the corpse was ugly or good-looking, what did that matter? Time was running out. Take the trip now or miss it. You get to be dead a long time, right?
"I'm on it," Tad said. "Give me 10 minutes.
Bobby nodded.
"I'm going to start the final mix now."
Tad waved him off. His stash was in his car and parked at the sandwich place. He'd have to go get it, come back, and hope he could find a vein he could hit. What a bitch. Washington, D.C. Tony spent an hour playing with the scrimshaw, then had to quit. Her ankles were swelling. Her right thumb and forefinger had gone numb from gripping the pin vise, and she was going blind looking through the magnifying lamp's lens. That stereoscopic microscope would sure come in handy. Yeah, so would some artistic talent and a lot more patience. Maybe this wasn't such a good idea, taking up something this precise. Maybe she was just wasting her time and a lot of effort. She went to the bathroom, washed her hands and face in cold water, and went into the living room. She sat on the couch. She could do her juru handiwork sitting down, most of it. The footwork was getting harder and harder to add in, and while Guru's advice had been not to worry about it, it would all come back after the baby was born, she did worry about it. The Indonesian martial art had been the core of who she was since she'd been 13. She was a warrior. Now a big, fat, pregnant warrior, putting scratches and itty-bitty dots on fake ivory instead of kicking ass? Some warrior. Tears rose and threatened to spill, but Tony angrily wiped her eyes. The comm chirped. Finally, she picked it up.
"Hello," she said.
"Hi, babe, it's me. How are you doing?"
Alex. Oh, boy. Was that the wrong thing for him to say?
"I hate my life."
He didn't say anything, but he didn't have to say anything. She had more. Much more. Quantico, Virginia.
"You want me to go along on a drug raid?" John Howard said.
Michaels nodded.
Yes. We have a vested interest here, even though it is officially a DEA matter. I just got off the comm with Brett Lee. They are willing to allow a NetForce liaison to tag along, if he's field qualified. In the interest of interagency cooperation, of course. Let me see if I can translate that. We need credit for this, right? Damn straight. This is going to be a high-profile bust. There's a lot of interest in catching these folks from way up the food chain. When the media figures out what this is connected to, we don't want to be left out in the cold. You standing there conspicuously in your NetForce blues on the 6 o'clock news will make sure nobody accidentally forgets to mention that it was us who located this evildoer and gave his location to the DEA. Howard smiled.
You're getting a lot better at this political infighting, Commander.
I'd say thank you, but I'm not sure I consider that a compliment.
Howard shrugged. Goes with the job. You don't watch out for us, you sure can't expect anybody else to do it. Certainly not the DEA or NSA. I'd be happy to go along and help our fellow crime fighters take down this dope peddler. It's been a little slow around here anyway.
Knock on wood, Michael said, rapping his desktop. In case there are any bored angels watching who want to give us something to worry about.
Amen.
After Howard left, Michael's secretary told him he had a call.
From?
Greta Henkel?
Why do I recognize that name?
She's the CEO and largest shareholder of Henkel Pharmaceuticals, which is headquartered in Mannheim, Germany.
Michaels rolled his eyes. Jesus, word was definitely out about this drug thing. He reached for the phone.
The conversation didn't take long, and when it was done, Michaels leaned back in his chair and shook his head. Ms. Henkel of Henkel Pharmaceuticals, the largest European drug manufacturing company and the fourth largest in the world, had offered him a job. Ostensibly, Ms. Henkel was looking for somebody to run their computer security department, and who better than the man who ran the computer security service for the United States government? She mentioned a starting salary that translated to roughly 4 times what he was making as a government employee, plus stock options and a medical and retirement package that would, in 20 years, make him a fairly wealthy man. It was tempting to think her offer was exactly what she said, an offer tendered on merit. A deserved and great opportunity. Michael smiled at that. What this was about, of course, was this damn purple capsule everybody wanted so bad. Probably Ms. Henkel wanted it to move her company from fourth to first place. Or maybe she wanted it so the Germans could gear up for another war with super soldiers. It didn't really matter. But she was assuming that if she paved a road with platinum for him to get there, Michaels would bring the secret of the stuff with him. It would be interesting to see if the job offer became real if he didn't happen to have that information at hand, or even how long his new job would last if he did. He declined the offer with appropriate regrets and thanked Ms. Henkel politely. Whatever the hell was in that mysterious capsule must be very interesting indeed. Beverly Hills, California. John Howard had a few friends still active in other services. An old Air Force buddy got him second seat on a fighter going across the country. Howard was more than 2 hours ahead of Mr. Brett Lee's commercial flight and waiting at the airport for him when he got off the plane. A small victory, but worth the effort for the look on the face of a man who had left Washington, D.C. an hour before Howard had and well knew it. Lee filled him in on details as they drove toward Beverly Hills.
The suspect's name is George Harris Ziegler, age 31.
He looked at Howard as if expecting some response, but the name didn't mean anything to him, and Howard said so.
He's a fairly well-known actor, Lee said. A pretty boy who plays action heroes, has the teenage girls all hot for him. They call him the Z-ster.
There you go, Howard said. I'm neither teenage nor female, and not much of a movie fan.
In any event, we have the warrants, and our surveillance teams have him at home. He lives in a big gated estate in Beverly Hills. We're going in hot and fast. We need to do this quick enough to get samples of the drug. He has bodyguards and a commercial security system. It is unlikely he is the chemist, but we think he either sells or gives the stuff to his friends. He doesn't need the money. He gets $15 or $20 million each for the movies he stars in. And you've never heard of him?
I guess I need to get out more.
Lee glared, but then forced a smile. It was his operation, and he would be giving Howard his assignment.
You will be assisting the agents covering the garage, in case Mr. Ziegler decides to try and escape. It's a 12-car garage, but he only has 10 in it at the moment. The usual toys, including a Ferrari, Land Cruiser, a Ford Cobra, a Dodge Viper, and a couple of antique Rolls Royces.
How many agents do you have going into the house?
16.
Ah, well, if he gets past you, we'll do our best to try and stop him.
When they got to the staging area, a local park, Howard pulled his gear out of his tactical duffel bag. He had his sidearm, the Medusa, his blue coveralls, and the spider silk vest with Net Force stenciled in big phosphorescent yellow letters across the back. He strapped on his revolver, slipped into the coveralls, and tabbed the vest into place. It was Class 1 armor with full side panels and a crotch drape. The tight weave silk and overlapping ceramic plates would stop most bullets, assuming the shooter went for the body and not the head or legs. Somehow he didn't think an actor who let himself be called the Z-ster would be doing much blasting. Rich folks generally fought with lawyers, not firearms, and his chances of getting past a whole slew of DEA agents armed with subguns were slim and snowball. During the briefing, Howard memorized the maps, met the two agents who'd be watching the garage with him. Their names were Brown and Peterson, a tall woman and a short man, respectively. Lee, despite his quick fuse, gave a pretty good sit rep and assignment layout. Everybody synchronized their watches and slipped into tactical radio headphones set to a narrowband op-chan. Whatever the DEA's political agendas, they had done enough drug busts to know how to enter a secured residence efficiently. They'd borrowed a tactical truck from the local police force, and it went through the heavy steel gate as if it were paper. The cars followed the truck in, five vehicles, and made for their assigned locations. Brown, Peterson, and Howard alighted and moved to the garage. Brown had an electronic master key she triggered, and the signal worked. The garage doors rolled up. All six of them. Peterson moved to stand behind the door from the garage into the house, his handgun pointed up by his ear. Brown crouched down behind the car closest to the door, a 70s Charger, a muscle car lovingly painted in maybe 20 hand-rubbed coats of metal flake candy apple red. Be ashamed to see that paint chipped by a bullet, Howard thought. He looked around. Which car would he take if he was in a real hurry? Probably the Cobra. Nah, better would be the Viper. Nobody would be catching that sucker. He walked over to the Viper and looked into the little convertible. Had to be real wood dash and steering wheel. Hello. What's this? Lying in plain view on the passenger seat was one of those zippered plastic bags like for sandwiches. Inside the bag were four big purple capsules. Howard grinned. Son of a bitch. Brown and Peterson were intent on the door. Orders from Lee rattled over the operations channel on the headset. They had crashed the front door after some effort and were entering the residence. Howard reached down, picked up the bag, opened it, and shook one of the capsules into his palm. He slipped the cap into his coverall pocket, zipped the bag closed, and dropped it back onto the car seat. The sounds of fully automatic weapon fire and Lee screaming over the headset came simultaneously.
Return fire! Return fire!
Well, looked like the bodyguards were earning their money. The DEA assault team carried MP5s, and the distinctive sound of those chattered, joining the other guns. All pistol-caliber stuff.
All available agents! They're heading for the kitchen!
The kitchen, Howard recalled from the maps, was just up a short hall from the garage. Brown and Peterson took this as a sign they should go in. Peterson jerked the door open, Brown stepped in, pistol leading. They didn't look for Howard, but vanished into the house. Howard, whose sidearm was still in the holster, considered his options. If 16 DEA agents couldn't take out a pretty boy movie star and his bodyguards, he wasn't going to be able to add much firepower. He'd stay right here, just like he'd been assigned. More shots echoed from the house. Somebody screamed, two or three different voices.
Shit! Fuck! Ow! Ow! I'm shot!
10 seconds later, a man emerged from the house into the garage. In one arm gathered to his chest, he held a young woman in a maid's uniform. From her face, the girl was in mortal terror, and rightly so, since in his other hand the guy held a short knife pressed against her neck. He was a handsome young man. This would be the Z-ster. Howard pulled his revolver, brought his other hand up and clasped the weapon in a two-handed grip, and pointed it at the knife man. "Hold it right there, Ziegler." The man froze. Ziegler tried to make himself smaller, but there was no way a 5-foot-tall, 100-pound woman was going to completely shield a 6-foot-tall, 200-pound man. Howard had all kinds of targets, including the only one that meant instant incapacitation, a headshot.
"Put the gun down! Put it down or I'll kill her!"
He had the shot. Sight square lined up on the man's left eye. At 15, maybe 16 feet, he wasn't going to miss. Not much risk to the woman, but some. And he'd have to kill the movie star.
"Listen," Howard said, "let's discuss this." "No fucking discussion! Put the gun down or I'll cut her throat!"
The maid whimpered.
"You don't want to do that. You kill her, you're standing there unprotected with a knife in your hand. Think about that. She's all that's keeping you alive. She dies, you die. Simple as that."
"You can't do that. Do you know who I am?"
"I'm not a cop, son. I'm a soldier. They trained me to kill, not capture. I see blood on that blade, it's a done deal. I don't care who you are. God doesn't love men who murder innocent women, and I expect he sent me here to teach you this."
The man was on the edge of panic.
"Let me go. I let her go."
"What, do I have the word stupid tattooed on my forehead? Put the knife down. You get to tell your story to a judge. You cut that woman, I guarantee you'll be dead before she is. Game over."
"You might hit her if you shoot."
Howard blew out a theatrical sigh.
"Let me explain some things to you, son. This weapon I am holding in my hands is a Phillips & Rogers 357 Model 47 Medusa. It's about as well-made and accurate a double-action revolver as you can get. I can hit an apple at 25 meters all day long, and you are less than one-third that far away. You understand? You want to think about how much of you I can see that's not behind your hostage?"
Ziegler swallowed dryly.
"Now, here's the deal. I don't give a rat's ass if you walk out of here or if the DA drags your dead body out. It's all the same to me. But if I have to shoot, this gun is going to make a terrible noise inside this garage, and probably my ears will ring for a couple days because I didn't think to put my plugs in before I came through the door. I'd just as soon not damage my hearing any more than I have to. So if I have to shoot, I am going to be real pissed off. I might as well shoot again. You following me? You put the knife down right now, or I will punch a hole in you, and when you fall, I'll pump a couple more in you for making my ears hurt. Your movie career might survive an arrest. You don't put that knife down, you won't. Simple as that. Your choice. Either the knife hits the floor, or you do."
Somebody was listening on the radio because Howard heard,
"Don't shoot him! Don't shoot him! We're on the way!"
Howard tongued the radio's off switch. He didn't need the distraction. He took a deep breath and let part of it out, held the rest, preparing for the shot.
Don't kill me, please!
Ziegler's left hand came away from the maid, releasing her, and made a pushing motion toward Howard.
"Come on, we can make a deal here. I'll give you my supplier. That's what you want, isn't it?"
The knife moved away from the maid's neck. Ziegler hadn't dropped it yet, but he was about to. His knife hand had already relaxed, and he had taken a half step away from his hostage. Howard let out another sigh, quieter this time. Thank you, Lord. That would have been all he needed, millions of teenage girls hating his guts for killing their screen idol. He'd dodged a bullet himself when that knife dropped. Somebody stepped around the corner from outside and into the garage and fired a handgun twice, hitting the suspect square in the chest. Ziegler collapsed. The maid screamed and fell to the floor, onto her hands and knees, scrambled for cover behind the muscle car. Instinctively, Howard spun toward the shooter, gun leading. It was Brett Lee. Lee quickly pointed his gun toward the ceiling, his other hand open and raised.
"Easy, easy!"
Howard said, "Why did you shoot, you fucking moron? He had dropped his weapon."
"Sorry. It looked like he was about to hurt the hostage."
"I thought you wanted him alive." Lee didn't say anything else. He put away his weapon. Howard shook his head, went to check on Ziegler. One in the heart, one in the upper chest. He'd be dead before the paramedics could get him to the ambulance. Shit. Howard stood, holstered his revolver, helped the crying hostage to her feet. "It's all over, ma'am. You're safe now." He glared at Lee. Sweet Jesus. He heard the sound of helicopters moving in and swore under his breath. He was going to take the vest off. No way he wanted the name NetForce to show up on the evening news after this fiasco. Commander Michaels would surely agree with that idea. More DEA agents boiled out of the house, guns waving around. Day late and a dollar short. What a snafu. Sweet Jesus. Net Force HQ, Quantico, Virginia.
So the only lead we had to the dealer is cooling on a slab at the morgue in sunny L.A.?
Yes, sir, John Howard said. Apparently to the regret of teenage girls everywhere.
Jesus, Michael said.
My feelings exactly. My guess is Mr. Lee of the DEA is going to have some tall explaining to do to his superiors.
Michael shook his head. Well, at least our information helped the DEA beat the NSA to the target.
Might have been better the other way, Jay observed. I kind of like the Zeister's movies myself. He had a certain style. That the first part of Jay's observation was a thought Michaels had already had didn't make it sit any better.
Well, the director can't fault us for what DEA screws up. What is the deal with NSA and DEA anyway? Some kind of ongoing bad blood?
Jay said, not that I know of. No more than any other interagency rivalry. CIA, FBI kind of thing. You get the ball, you don't pass it, you shoot, even if we're all on the same team.
What about personal histories? Agent Lee and Mr. George go to competing schools, sleep with each other's girlfriends?
Jay looked surprised.
Never thought of that. Maybe it's not relevant, but why don't you poke around a little and see what you can find? Doesn't seem as if these two have any great love for each other, and I'd just as soon not get Net Force splattered with incidental mud if these two are going to keep throwing it at each other.
Jay nodded. Good idea, boss. I'll do that.
Even though it's primarily their problem, we have to help them keep looking, and right now, all we've got is a dead movie star and a dead end.
Not altogether, Howard said. He grinned, showing bright teeth against his chocolate skin. There is the matter of the recovered capsules. Unfortunately, they were near the end of their lifespan. The movie star could afford to buy them and let them go bad if he wanted to, and by the time the DEA got the things to their lab, they were so much inert powder internally.
Which doesn't do us much good, does it?
Michaels said. Well, sir, probably not. But while you'll notice that the report says there were three of the capsules, that is actually in error. Howard dropped a purple cap onto his desktop. Jay grinned.
General, you swiped one?
Liberated it. Won't do us any more good chemically than the ones the DEA's got, but I figured what they could learn from four, they could learn from three. Michaels picked up the cap.
Well, as it happens, we have a friend in the FBI lab who would like to get his hands on this. That way at least we'd know as much as the DEA about what's in it. Their lab techs are second to none. Might be they could come up with something. I'll run this past them and see what they can find. Good work.
Thank you, sir.
And I was very happy not to see you on the news.
I thought you might be. Malibu, California.
Don't take the hammer, Bobby said.
Tad, whose last little hit of heroin was wearing off, frowned through the start of a headache.
Why not? Because I need you straight.
Tad grinned his lopsided grin.
Well, okay, relatively straight. We got problems. We're rich and good-looking. How bad could it be?
The Zeister's dead.
No way. I just saw him. Gave him the caps from that last batch. He looked great.
I got a contact in the police who says his body's in a big drawer at the New County Morgue.
Oh, geez, that's too bad. What did he do, wrap one of his cars around a tree?
He was shot twice in the heart by a DEA agent leading a drug raid on his mansion.
Whoa, you're shitting me.
Yeah, it's awful and all, but stop and think about what that means. Why would the feds be going after the Zeister? He's a user, not a dealer.
He spreads it around some. Could be they caught somebody he ran with. They gave him up.
Whatever, but this puts us in a kind of bad spot. We ran with him, too. Somebody might remember us.
Remember me, you mean? You look like 10,000 other surfer dudes. Me, I kind of stand out.
Bobby waved that off. The point is, we let ourselves get public with him more than we should have. If he had the hammer caps on him when they took him out, they're going to go over his background with a microscope. Everywhere he went, everybody he saw, somebody will cover all of the trendy places where the Zeister liked to party. Here's what I want you to do.
You search your memory and dig up every time you saw Z in public. Anywhere might have had a security cam lit. Get to those places before the feds or the local police do. Get the recordings or wipe them or whatever.
Yeah, I can do that.
I've made up a list of the places where I went with him alone, or where you and him and me were. Add those to your list. Crowd he traveled with, they don't know us well enough to send anybody here. Hell, they were usually too stoned to know who they were, much less us.
Tad nodded.
Yeah, I got it. Only a few places they might have captured images of us.
We can't do shit about some tourist who snapped a few frames of Ziegler while we were at Disneyland or the beach or whatever, but the feds probably won't find him either. I think we can ride this out. We do it right.
I wonder how did they figure out to go for him?
He fucked up. He liked to brag about doing five girls at a time while he was on the hammer, and like you said, he passed out dope to the people around him like it was chewing gum. Doesn't matter how they found him. What matters is they don't find us.
I hear that.
Tad had no desire to finish out his little remaining time on Earth in a cell. He'd punch his own ticket before he'd let that happen.
So we're on vacation for the next couple months, Bobby said. No production, no deliveries. We are shut down. Maybe we'll go to Maui, drive the crooked road out to Hana, kick back on the black sand beach, and watch the girls a while.
Tad nodded absently.
Yeah.
But what he was thinking was, he had Thor's hammer in his pocket, the last one Bobby had made, and it still had a few more hours of shelf life left. If he didn't take it, it was going to go to waste, and Bobby wasn't going to be making any more until he felt safe. Tad might not have a couple months left in him. You never could tell. Should he take it? He and Bobby hadn't spent that much time with the Z-ster out in public. Half a dozen spots in the last couple of months, no more. And most places didn't keep vid records more than a day or two, maybe a week, before they recorded over the old stuff. He could shave it close, check out the first few places, drop the cap, and finish the last few before it came on full blast. And even after it came on, he could maintain enough to take care of the security stuff, he was pretty sure. For a couple hours, anyway. There was some risk, sure, but what the hell? He didn't have much to lose, did he?
You gonna sit there staring into space all day, or what?
Huh? Oh, yeah, I'm going. I need to, freshen up a bit, then I'm good.
Fine. Do whatever you need to do, but don't get pulled over for a ticket or whatever. Be careful, okay?
Yeah, don't worry.
I have to worry, Tad, for both of us.
Tad headed for the bathroom and another hit of the Mexican White. As he walked, he fingered the capsule in his watch pocket to make sure it was still there. As long as he took care of business, what could it hurt to take it? It would be a crime to just waste it. He smiled at himself in the bathroom mirror. It was like looking at a grinning skull. Drain was pissed off at himself. He knew better than to associate with people he dealt to. He knew better. He'd talked to a lot of dope dealers over the years, had wrangled access to a lot of FBI files via his father, without the old man knowing, of course, and he'd learned a whole lot about the biz before he had ever sold his first pill. The upside of things were big bucks and big thrills. Dopers who were smart made fortunes. There was a downside, of course. Stupid dopers could get killed by a rival dealer, or ripped off and maybe killed by a customer, or busted and sent to the Gray Bar Hotel for 20 years. The thing was, if you were a dealer, and if you did it long enough, and if you didn't move around, you were sooner or later going to get caught. 99.99% of dealers who stayed in the biz for more than a few years in one place eventually got nailed. Sometimes it was a distributor who gave them up. Sometimes it was an ex-wife or girlfriend. Sometimes the cops found them on their own. Once you got a lot of cash in your hands, it sometimes made you stupid. You bought expensive, flashy toys. You got to thinking because you were rich, you were invincible. And just like Ziegler, all your money didn't mean squat when the bullets started to fly. You couldn't take it with you. So Drain had always kept a low profile. No yachts, no car that couldn't be leased by half of L.A., no bodyguards. Absolutely minimal risks in sales, delivery, taking on new customers. Never more stuff in the house than necessary. Nobody knew what he did except for three people, Tad and the old couple who drove the RV. Tad would never give him up, and Ma and Pa Yeehaw were lifetime criminals who would go down guns blasting before they let themselves be taken. Not perfect, no ironclad guarantees, but he had been very careful, until he got sucked into the glitz of Ziegler's movie star circles. It had never occurred to him that Ziegler would be the target of a raid. Feds just didn't kick in famous millionaires' doors. It just wasn't done. Well, it was now. And while they were probably okay, going to ground and turning invisible until all the heat died down was the way to play it. A month or two in Hawaii in the fall? You could do a lot worse. Soon as Tad got things taken care of, they were going to zip on out to the islands. By the time they got back, all this other stuff would be old news. Old news. Washington, D.C. Tony was going stir-crazy. She had cabin fever big time, and she had to get out of the house before she went totally bonkers. Yes, the doctor had told her to stay home and confine herself to light activity, because, the doctor had said, if there were any more problems with cramping or bleeding and she wanted this baby, she was going to wind up spending the rest of the pregnancy in bed, so best she not cause things to get to that state by being overactive. Tony didn't really have any place she wanted or needed to go. On a whim, Tony called Joanna Winthrop.
Hey, Tony, how's the pregnancy going?
Awful. I feel like a bloated cow. Joanna laughed.
I hear that, and I sympathize completely.
Alex doesn't understand. I know I'm whining, I can't stop myself, and as soon as I start, he runs and hides in the garage. I think he's leaving early and coming home late from work just to stay out of my way.
Bet on it.
Tony sighed.
So how is your baby? The demon child from hell?
What? Joanna laughed.
He's great. That's just what we call him when we can't figure out why he's crying.
Does that happen a lot?
Not really.
Jesus, Tony said.
What have I done?
Joanna laughed again.
I'm kidding, sweetie. He's a terrific kid, worth every penny. How are you doing, really?
Tony explained about her scrimshaw and about how she was feeling cooped up.
Why don't you come on over and visit us? The baby is asleep. He'll be out for another couple hours, and I'd love to see you again. I've missed the crew at work.
Me too.
You sure it's okay?
Of course I'm sure. I'm a new mama, and you're gonna be in a few months. If we can't help each other, who will? Tony felt as if her load had been lightened immeasurably.
Thanks, Joanna. I'm on my way.
Malibu, California. Bobby's work phone jangled. He frowned. Only a few people had the number, which was supposedly a direct line to his office. He went to the kitchen and touched the comm's caller ID button. Nothing. Whoever was calling was blocked. He tapped the speaker button.
Polymers, drain, he said.
Hello, Robert.
Jesus Christ.
Dad? How are you?
Me? I'm fine. How are you? Everything okay?
I am well.
How's the dog?
He's fine.
There was a long pause.
What's up, Dad?
I have some bad news, I'm afraid. You remember your Aunt Edwina's son, Carlton?
Aunt Edwina's son. He couldn't have just said your cousin?
Yeah, sure.
Well, he was in a boating accident yesterday. He passed away in the hospital this morning.
Creepy's dead?
Jesus.
I asked you not to call him that, Robert.
Drain shook his head. His father would remember that. Still worried about the name, even though the man was dead. Carlton Post had been called Creepy as long as Drain could remember. He was 3 years younger than Drain, and whenever his folks had come to visit, Edwina was his old man's younger sister, they'd brought their four kids along. Creepy was the only boy. Drain didn't know who had nicknamed him in the first place. The oldest girl cousin, Creepy's sister Irene, had passed the name along to Drain once when she and Drain had been teaching each other how to play doctor. The name came from the way he stared at people. He'd been a shrimpy little black-haired boy who looked at you without blinking for what sometimes seemed like 10 minutes.
What happened?
Drain hadn't known Creepy that well, but hearing about his death left him feeling oddly distressed.
He was water skiing. Apparently he fell and was run over by another boat.
His father related the information as if talking about the weather. No excitement, no grief. Deadpan. Fell. Run over. Cut. Always the cool federal agent.
Oh, man, that's awful.
Creepy was dead. It was hard to imagine. He'd actually turned out okay. A nice guy.
The funeral will be day after tomorrow at Edwina's church in Newport Beach. I'll be driving up for it.
His father was coming to L.A. Well, shit. So much for jetting off to Hawaii.
You, need a place to stay?
Nope, I'll stay at Edwina's. She'll need family support. The funeral will be at 10 o'clock. Can you get off work to attend?
That was the kind of man his father was. If he'd still been working for the FBI when his nephew had been killed, he would have worried about shit like that. Sure, he'd have taken a personal day and gone, but he would have fretted over missing work. Duty was his reason to get up in the mornings. Drain said,
Sure, no problem. I can take off. We're going to meet at Patrick and Edwina's at 9 and then drive over to the church, the Newport Beach Community Presbyterian.
I can find it.
Good. I'll see you then. Goodbye, Robert.
Drain tapped the speaker button and shut the comm off. That was his old man. No emotion in his voice that his sister's only son was dead. Drain sighed. Well, okay, this was going to put a small crimp in his plans, but Creepy had been his cousin. It was family. You couldn't just not go. Shit. First it was Ziegler, then Creepy. Bad things came in threes. He hoped the next one wouldn't be Tad. Or himself. Stonewall Jackson High School Cafeteria, Cool Springs, Georgia, December 1992. Jay Gridley stood in the cafeteria line. The woman behind the counter slopped a big ice cream scooper full of mashed potatoes onto his compartmentalized baby blue Melmac plate. She handed the plate back. This was where Mr. Brett Lee of the Drug Enforcement Administration had gone to high school before going off to Georgia Tech to get his master's in criminology. He'd gone to work for the DEA the year after he had graduated college. In the real world, Jay would be looking at the school yearbooks, talking to teachers and fellow students, downloading pictures and stats, and putting together an education history of Mr. Lee. In VR, he had built a scenario that would let him walk through the school itself, or rather what he imagined a place named after a Southern Civil War hero might look and feel like, and absorbing the information in a much more interesting manner. Lee had been well-liked, had gotten good grades, and had hung with jocks, having been a middle-distance runner on the school's track team. Jay had come back as far as high school because he had not been able to discover any connection between Brett Lee and Zachary George, either in their work careers or college. Lee had been born and raised in Georgia, while George had grown up in Vermont. When Lee was at Georgia Tech, George had been at the University of New York. They had not crossed paths that Jay could tell until they were both working for the federal government, and while there was no record of their first meeting there, there was some kind of friction apparent by the time both had been in harness for a few years. Maybe they just rubbed each other the wrong way or something. The young Lee, sitting at a table with four guys and two girls from the track teams, dipped a French fry in ketchup and ate it as Jay moved to sit at a conveniently empty table behind the group. Convenient hell. He had designed the setup that way himself. The conversation was hardly enlightening. They talked about things of interest to teenagers. Music, movies, who was going out with whom, teachers they hated, the usual. And in the 20-year-old jargon, it was pitifully dated. Lee was close to Jay's age, and if he'd talked like this, he must have seemed a terrible dweeb to any passing adult.
Yeah, well, Austin is a dickhead dweeb, one of the boys said. He gave me a fucking C on the midterm because I didn't use the right color ink.
One of the girls, a pretty bottle blonde, said,
Yeah, but he's kind of cute.
The other girl, a brunette with hair worn so short as to almost be a crew cut, said,
Yeah. Too bad he's gay.
One of the boys said,
Gay? Shit, he ain't gay. I seen him looking up Sissy Lou's skirt and getting a hard-on in debate one.
He could die of boredom here, Jay thought. Brett Lee said,
He's not queer, he's just smart is all. He got us that trip to the debate finals in Washington, D.C.
So, the blonde said to Brett,
You go into the debate thing?
Yeah, There's going to be people from all over the country there. I'm going. I'm not going to live the rest of my life here in Hickburg. I'm going to meet people, make friends, get myself a job where I can make a shitload of money and retire by the time I'm 40.
Jay shook his head. He'd heard enough of this. Then, as he was about to leave, he had a thought. Maybe Zachary George had been interested in debate in high school. Huh. Well, he could take a little run up to Montpelier High and check that out. Easy enough to do when you were Jay Gridley, master of virtual space and time. Quantico, Virginia. On the way home, Michael's Virgil played a few bars of Franz Liszt's Les Préludes, a somber, regal musical sting that, according to Jay Gridley, was the basis for the theme that announced the Emperor Ming in the old Flash Gordon movie series in the 30s. It was Susie. He saw her tiny picture appear on his Virgil screen, and he activated his own minicam so she could see him.
Hey, yo, Daddy-o.
Daddy-o? What happened to Dadster?
Oh, that's so yesterday.
How are you?
Fine.
Everything going okay with, Byron?
Yep. He's a good guy, really.
Michaels felt his belly clutch. He had thought he was going to lose contact with her after the nasty business with Megan, but somehow his ex-wife had relented. Thank God for large miracles.
I'm glad to hear it,
he said. Boy, that came hard.
He argued with Mom something awful about letting me see you.
Michaels felt the heat begin in him. That bastard.
Didn't like the idea, huh?
He managed to say, faking a smile. She could see him, after all.
Oh, no, Daddy-o, it was Mom who didn't like it. Byron said it wasn't right to keep a father from seeing his daughter. He wouldn't give up until she agreed.
Michael's anger turned to wonder.
Really?
Yeah, he doesn't like you much after you insulted Mom and knocked him down, but he tries to be fair. He's just not you. I miss you, Dad.
As always, that broke his heart.
Me too. You tell Byron thank you for me, would you?
He debated for a moment about whether to tell his preteen daughter that she was going to have a new little brother. Well, half-brother. Then he decided she ought to hear it from him.
I have some news for you. Did you know you're going to have a baby brother in a few months?
Mom told? She told me I couldn't say anything to you, but it's not a brother, it's a sister.
For a moment, he couldn't track what she said. Then it came to him. Megan was pregnant.
Pretty cool, huh? A baby sister. Almost none of my friends have any that little. Nobody else's mom is preggers.
Pretty cool. Congratulations.
Susie's slip brought up a whole wave of things he didn't want to think about. He loved Tony, and she loved him in a way Megan never had. He was over his ex-wife, finally. But she was Susie's mother, and there had been some good times, wonderful times, at the beginning. Now that she was having another man's baby, the old jealousy tried to rear its viper-like head, and for a moment, he could almost let it. No, that serpent was dead. And now, what did he tell Susie about her half-brother? Should he say anything? He didn't want to get into any kind of competition with Megan for his daughter's affection. And yet, if he was going to continue to be part of Susie's life, Tony was also going to be a part of it, as would their unborn child.
Well, little bit, it looks like you are going to be really cool.
He smiled into the Virgil. Santa Monica, California. The Safari Bar and Grill was first on Tad's list. This was an old but little-known watering hole not far from Santa Monica City College. Tad approached the assistant manager on duty and gave him the bullshit story he'd worked up.
Say, man, I got a problem. Maybe you can help me with?
The assistant manager, a smiling black guy of 30, said,
What's the problem, bro?
Okay, look, a while back, my brother and his wife were having some difficulties. I, got together with her to, you know, help him out. We had lunch here a few times.
Uh-huh, so?
One thing kind of led to another. My sister-in-law and I, well, we, stepped over the line. You know what I mean?
You punching your brother's wife? That's bad biz, bro. Gonna make Thanksgiving dinners a bitch.
Yeah, I know. It just happened, you know? Anyway, They got their shit worked out okay. They're back together. But my brother, he's a jealous type, and he suspects that while they were on the outs, his wife maybe did some stuff she shouldn't have done. Yeah, he's right, too, isn't he?
Tad looked at his boots.
Yeah, and I feel like shit about it, okay? But he only suspects. He doesn't know, and he sure as hell don't know about me. Thing is, my brother is big and kind of mean, and he's with the cops, and if he starts poking around and finds out his wife and I spend any time together, I'm fucked.
I hear that.
So, like I said, we were in here a few times, had a few drinks and a few laughs, and if he shows up here somehow and gets his hands on your security tapes, I could be in deep shit.
The assistant manager smiled.
Not to worry, my man. You hear further back than a week, he won't find nothing. We record 3 days at a time. Nobody sticks up the place or starts a fight. The police need to see we start the disc over again. No permanent records.
Tad smiled.
Hey, man, I appreciate you telling me this.
He pulled a couple of tight-folded 20s from his pocket and extended his hand. When they shook hands, the 20s pressed into the assistant manager's palm, and he grinned and nodded.
No problem, bro. You be more careful now, you hear? That pussy will kill you. You're not careful.
After the safari, Tad rumbled the big Dodge along surface streets to two other restaurants within a few miles of each other and ran the same story. At the Sun and Shore, it played pretty much the same, except for the time. The security cams there recorded over the old stuff after only 24 hours. Not to sweat it. At the Irish pub, they had cams, but all they did was feed a couple of show monitors. No tapes or discs. Tad was feeling pretty good about this. Two places left on Bobby's list, and neither one of them was going to be as tough as the hotel. One was a movie house that Zeister rented to show one of his pictures to 100 of his closest friends at the moment. The other was a gym where Bobby and the Zeister had worked out together a couple of times. Probably neither one of them even had security cams, but if they did, between his sister-in-law story and a pocket full of cash, he didn't foresee any problems. People would help you out if the story was good enough, and if they were a little reluctant, a fat wad of green went a long way to moving things along. Everybody had a price. You just had to find it. So there was no reason not to pick up the hammer that Tad could see. He swallowed the big purple cap, washed it down with a swig of bottled water, and headed for the movie theater. Washington, D.C., April 1991. The ballroom at the hotel was crowded, mostly fairly well-dressed teenagers with a sprinkling of teachers and employees here and there. Jay walked through the 20-year-old scenario, looking at the students as they headed for their seats. This was the quarterfinal round for the debate, whose topic this year was Resolved, Imminent Threats to National Security Should Supersede Habeas Corpus. Boy, didn't that sound exciting. Jay had learned in his research that debate teams were given an issue at the beginning of the year, and that this issue would be the same nationwide. The teams, two on a side, had to be able to argue both sides of an issue. The reason Jay was here was because the DEA agent Brett Lee and the NSA agent Zachary George had both attended this conference as teenagers. It could have been a coincidence. There were hundreds of students here, but maybe this was where the two had run afoul of each other originally. That would make sense, Jay reasoned. Being on opposite sides of a debate would mean that one would lose and the other would win, and maybe arguments had gotten heated to the point of personal anger. However, a check of the records once he got to looking revealed that Lee and George had not been on teams that debated each other. In fact, neither of their teams made it to the finals. Jay's scenario was based on old news footage, hotel records, and camcorder tapes and photographs taken by students and teachers, as well as the official society recordings that had been compiled and sold commercially. The net was still in its infancy in the early 90s, but there were some old debate web pages. Jay had set his search bots and blenders and strained it all, feeding it into a simple WYSIWYG view program. Added a few bells and whistles, of course. So there he sat with the Nebraskans and the Vermontians, the Vermontanese, about ready to go at it. Zachary George was the leader of his duo, and he was the opening speaker for the round. He got up, defined terms, and began his introduction to his reasoning. Jay was busy looking around, trying to spot Lee. It didn't take long. The young Brett Lee, looking much as he had in Jay's earlier scenario at Stonewall Jackson High, watched George from a third-row seat, leaning forward eagerly, hanging on every word. Jay got up and walked to a point where he could see Lee's face.
Huh.
Lee's expression certainly did not seem like that of a young man who scorned what he was hearing. It was more like a believer hearing a sermon by his favorite preacher, or a young man listening to the words of his beloved. Could these two have been friends who later had a falling out? This definitely needed more exploration, Jay decided. But scenario could only do so much. Whether in scenario or RW, if it wasn't there, any speculation about an event was just that, speculation. The program would let Jay make anything he wanted to happen in VR happen, but it would not necessarily be what actually happened. Despite Jay's best efforts, he could not put the two boys together at the debate conference outside the presentation done at the quarterfinal competition. There were a few records after the quarterfinals on both boys, but nothing that put the two of them in any closer proximity than they were in Jay's scenario. Even so, Jay felt there was something buried here, something he needed to uncover. The problem was, how?